What I thought we would do is we might move a couple of the less formal, a couple of briefings, quick briefings up front, so John will be here for the regulatory decision-making process. So why don't we start off with introductions around the table. We'll go around the, I'll try to do my best John Quinn impersonation. We'll go around the ACAC table first, and then we'll go around the rest of the room. So I'm Pat Abern, I'm the air director with MDE.
Lauren Garrison, pediatric toxicologist, representing the Children's Environmental Health and Protection Advisory.
Cindy Yelm, University of Maryland School of Medicine.
Leah Mack, Greenbelt City Council, representing the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments.
Sarah Tomlinson, I'm a planner with the Baltimore Metropolitan Council.
Cindy Parker, Johns Hopkins University, Bloomberg School of Public Health.
Hussein Wahid, Regulation Development.
Sugarantic General Public.
Jonathan Cades, University of Maryland Extension, Natural Resource Extension Specialist, and just visiting.
Ross Solowitz, University of Maryland.
Larry Schoen, Schoen Engineering, representing Mechanical Engineering Society.
John Coombe, EA Engineering, representing the American Institute of Chemical Engineers.
Diane Ferencz, Air Quality Planning Program Manager here at MDE.
Before we go around the rest of the room, do we have anybody on the phone that is on the council participating?
Yes, Kevin Barnabas with MakeOut.
Hey, Kevin, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Anybody else on the phone? And I'd like to welcome Dr. Parker to our advisory council. She's filling a vacant spot for Hopkins. So we've done a lot of good work with Cindy. She will be a welcome addition to our committee. We've really built a good committee over the past 5 years, very active, very engaged. So welcome to the process, and I'm glad to have you aboard. So now for the rest of the room, why don't we start over here. So what I was going to propose, I'm sorry.
Dr. Maver, MD. Jim Miller, MD.
Randy Mosier, MD.
And Carolyn Jones with MD.
Kathleen Waynes, MDE.
I just told you, may have a few more that just joined on the phone. Anybody else that didn't introduce themselves earlier on the phone line? Okay, so what I was going to propose is that we start off with a couple of the briefings, keep them short, non-action item briefings. The chair will be here in a few minutes, we believe. So, Marcia, I was going to ask you to come up and do a quick briefing on the low-sulfur home heating oil and maybe the aftermarket catalyst.
The call is going to be the aftermarket catalyst. We need to run a little bit late, so we can defer that one, but I can start with the sulfur.
Okay.
Sure, I just had... this was just a quick briefing for you. I know in the past I've been here, and Pat has mentioned the efforts that the state has undertaken as part of the Mid-Atlantic Northeast Disability Union, MainView, and their efforts to reduce sulfur dioxide and its contribution to regional haze. And part of that process was an agreement for the states to move forward with reducing sulfur in heating oils, fuel oils. So we've worked with the comptroller, who has an active program doing sampling and testing of fuel oils. It's taken a little longer than we expected, but we finally got the first step of the regulation done. On October 3rd, it was proposed, and it became effective on October 13th of this year. So beginning July 1st of 2016, the fuel oil specs will be 500 parts per million sulfur in Maryland. We're moving consistent with DC. I think they're also looking at 500 parts per million in that time frame. It's consistent with Pennsylvania. The next commitment that we're here to brief you on a little bit today was just, it was a two-step process to go to 500 parts per million and then to go to 15 parts per million as a final standard in 2018. So just wanted to let you know that we are going to be talking with the industry as well as the controller about moving forward with that next step of going to 15 parts per million sulfur in fuel oil by July 1st of 2018. We hope to have that worked out and on the books sometime next year to give plenty of lead time.
So a little background. MainView, Mid-Atlantic Northeast Visibility Union, is a group of states that work together on improving visibility. Part of the Clean Air Act requires that we return visibility to pristine conditions in the past by 2064. So maybe a few of you were around the table here. But it's a very interesting program, and it's a different program for us. It deals with how do you improve visibility in across the country, but focused primarily in federal parks. It's been very interesting. And we've made great progress over the past 10 years to get to where we need to be in 2064. We established sort of a glide path where in increments we have to improve something called deciviews, which is your ability to see through the air. And seeing through the air has a lot of factors. It's not just the stuff up there. It's the way the stuff up there reflects the sun. You know, and certain types of stuff up there that reflects the sun is worse than others. And so what we found is that SO2 controls has really improved visibility. And SO2 controls, as you all know, has also been the key to driving down fine particulate levels in the East. So on the glide path, we are way ahead of the curve, which is really good. And we work very closely with the federal land managers on this program. And this low sulfur home heating oil piece is one element of a multi-pronged strategy to continue to make progress, making sure we can see through the air in really national parks. It also helps us with our fine particulate problem, which is an important part of why we're doing it. The first part, we've had a lot of working relationships with the Maryland Petroleum Council and other folks in Maryland. They're not here today, but their concern has been just make sure that Maryland is being consistent with everybody else. And so this is a regional effort. We've done phase one. We will be moving on to phase two. We will be working with the Maryland Petroleum Council and the other affected business folks and other stakeholders as we move towards phase two. Taking sulfur out of fuel has been a theme you've heard a lot about over the past 10 years. We've taken sulfur out of truck fuels. But the Tier 3 program we briefed you on a couple months ago, a big federal program, is now going to be taking sulfur out of a single vehicle. Smart vehicle fuel. So it's been a big thing, and so far it's worked fairly well. But stay tuned. Phase two is coming. So why don't we tee up the control of SO2 emissions briefing, since Carl's not here to do the aftermarket catalyst. We got a couple briefings today. One is we are working on a power plant regulation looking at SO2 reductions. We also are working on a new mobile source control strategy to require California aftermarket catalysts for taking NOx out of vehicles. So I'll walk through this one real quick. I don't think it's terribly long, and hopefully by the end of the time we get through this, John will be here. So hey, Kev, how are you?
Good.
So this is not action item?
No. Oh, I'm sorry.
This is not an action item. This is just a briefing. We briefed you on the past on this one. This is a fairly important one. Our first step was to move forward with the NOx regulation. ACAC took an action on that. That's now in the process, and we're still working with some of the affected sources. But just a little background. I wanted to talk about the program in general, the key role of how modeling is used as part of this process. A brief glimpse of the modeling to date and the next steps. We've given you some of this before, but we do have a new SO2 standard. EPA finalized it in 2010, 75 parts per billion as a one-hour standard. A one-hour standard is a challenging standard to figure out how to implement. In August of 2013, EPA did do designations, and only a very few number of areas across the country were designated non-attainment, simply because the monitors aren't set up right. This program is very focused on exposures right around large stationary sources. So one of the steps that's going on is putting up some monitors. So Maryland has not been designated non-attainment yet, but we are on a path to comply. We can set up monitors. We also are talking about there's an early attainment option in the EPA guidance on how to comply with this, and that's what we're hoping to pursue in Maryland. Why? Healthy Air Act did drive a very significant investment into SO2 controls. Virtually all of our very large power plants have scrubbers on them, state-of-the-art scrubbers. Our Morgantown facility is probably one of the best performing units in the country. So not all sources, however, added the state-of-the-art controls, and that's one of the things we're looking at is how those sources in particular work with this particular standard. EPA's guidance does allow states to move forward more quickly. The federal process is going to stretch out to 2022. The guidance does allow states to move forward more quickly. And through an early attainment option, you can avoid being designated non-attainment at all. You can totally avoid that process. Probably more importantly is that you're also going to be ensuring that the public health protection starts as expeditiously as practical, which is the requirement under the Clean Air Act. So we are very interested in this early attainment option, particularly since so many of our sources have the high-end controls on already. I will tell you that, so a key part of this is using models. I'll go through what the models help us do in a minute, but we literally use models to figure out how much emissions a certain unit can have to ensure that they won't exceed the standard. And this is a very different process. Usually the way that we do standards is you set up a monitoring network, you monitor for 3 years, you figure out whether you have exceedances of those monitors, and then you develop plans, and it stretches out for quite a long time. But because this particular standard is so focused on large stationary sources and exposures right close into those large stationary sources, we'd like to move ahead more quickly if we can. A little bit on the Healthy Air Act. I seem to bring this back to you guys all the time. I will not let you forget. It is the largest single emission reducing program ever implemented in Maryland. It did a great job. It really helped bring us into attainment of the fine particle standard. Not only are we attaining the fine particle standard, we're continuing to trend downward. So that's a real success story in Maryland. While we're there, I should have updated this slide. Also helped us comply with the ozone standard. I didn't do my introduction to do that when John gets here, but we've made great progress reducing ozone. I've shown you some of that in past presentations. We've got more to do. A new tougher ozone standard was just proposed by EPA, so there's still a whole lot more work to do, but we've made great progress with ozone, and the Healthy Air Act was a big piece of that. The new one-hour standard does require a different regulatory scheme than the Healthy Air Act drove. The Healthy Air Act allowed companies to choose between their units and invest in the biggest bang for the buck. You know, you can add the controls with the big annual large emitting units, get the biggest dollar per ton. It worked very well. Huge reductions. But this standard, which focuses on individual units and exposures close into those individual units, it's a different animal. It requires a different regulatory scheme than the Healthy Air Act. You guys have seen this probably way too many times, but this is our SO2 reductions, and can you see where the Healthy Air Act kicked in? And in 2010, you just saw dramatic reductions in all of our units. These are annual emissions, so some of the peak day emissions aren't shown here, but on an annual basis, the Healthy Air Act really did a great job, drove down emissions. It's been a big success. So the modeling. EPA has approved models to use in analyzing SO2 emissions and SO2 exposures from individual plants. Some of you on ACAC-2 models, so this is probably overly simplistic, but the models use a lot of the physical data from the plant, things like stack heights, exit velocities. These are single plant models, not the big photochemical models we use for ozone. Of course, the emissions data, meteorological data, and topographical data. And topography and geography can be a challenge sometimes. And the models can actually be used to work backwards to figure out what the emissions should be to make sure that exposures off the plant property aren't above the standard. So this is the key tool that we're using to move forward with this reg. So we've been working on this for quite a while, and a lot of folks have done some modeling. We, Maryland, have done our own modeling. We're working with our power plant research program to do this modeling. Sierra Club has also done some modeling to look at this particular pollutant. And I believe that Raven and NRG are both moving forward with modeling of their own. So lots of folks doing lots of modeling. So a little bit of what our models tell us right now. So I'll start with Raven Power first. And Raven has an interesting challenge in that three of their plants are close to each other. It's not like one plant out in the middle of nowhere so you can model the plant by itself. Brandon Shores, Wagner, and Crane are all fairly close to each other, so you really need to model them together, which actually creates a new challenge in terms of how to make the models work. Some of the results. We're showing both the Sierra Club, the MDE power plant research numbers for a standalone situation, ignoring the other plants, but then also looking at the three plants close in. When you model them together, what do you get out of that? You don't need to go through these numbers right now, but these will eventually form the basis of the reg. What this tells you, anytime you see a complicated slide from me, you just have to wait for the fly-in. It'll say this is what you really need to focus on. This would give these units at Crane about a 1,400 pound per hour limit. And so it's just a benchmark to look at. We're working with the sources on how difficult or easy that will be. At the end, I'll talk about all the next steps we're going to go through to get this regular headline. The Wagner plant, another one close, located together with Grand Shores and Crane. Again, I wouldn't worry too much about all the details, but the bottom line is that it would drive about 1,000 pounds per area, 1,000 pounds per hour for unit three, and a 500 pounds per hour for unit two. Probably a little more detail than I should have had, but it's just to give you a feel for how we're using the models to drive regulatory limits. Grand Shores, again, Sierra Club's results, our results for a standalone scenario, and our results for the cumulative scenario, again, about 1,000 pounds per hour limit for each unit at Brandon Shores. NRG's got other interesting challenges. Different plants, they're not all located together, but there are some interesting issues we need to work through with NRG. All of the energy units have really good SO2 controls on them already. High-end SO2 scrubbers at all of the units. That doesn't actually make it super easy. It makes it much easier, but there are some issues we're struggling with. The way the system was designed is that you will every once in a while need to maintain the CEM measurement system or the unit itself, and so you'll have to take the unit down, and when the unit goes down, it vents to a bypass stack, a tall stack, but a bypass stack. And so since this is a one-hour standard where 1 hour of emissions can matter, we're having to look at that situation of the bypass. Now, what's positive about it, it's a tall stack, but it creates an interesting challenge for us in terms of looking at units that already have state-of-the-art SO2 controls. Again, some of the results. We've given you sort of the routine operation numbers, the scrubber stack results for Chalk Point, and the bypass stack results we've done. Again, I wouldn't get too worked up about the details of the numbers. I just wanted to give you a feel for how the modeling works and where it leads us in this regulatory process. So with the scrubber, about 2,400 pounds per hour for all the units. They all vent to one stack. That's another difference between the NRG system and the Raven system. Again, for bypass, 11,500 pounds per hour for all the units that all vent to one stack. Working pound. Again, the scrubber stack scenario and the bypass stack scenario. And by the way, the Morgantown plant is the one I mentioned earlier, probably one of the top-performing coal-fired power plant units in the East. Achieves extremely low levels. And for them, the scrubber, the modeling tells us the scrubber scenario should be about 1,500 pounds per hour, and the bypass stack scenario about 7,500 pounds per hour. Dickerson, an interesting challenge because the Dickerson unit is located, topography and geography becomes a challenge. There are Maryland mountain areas around, so we're looking at the topography and geography. It makes it an interesting challenge. But again, just to give you a feel, the scrubber scenario about 1,000 pounds per hour, the bypass stack scenario about 8,900 pounds per hour. And again, those are all units because they vent to one simple stack. So where are we? We've done a lot of the initial work on this. We were very busy with the NOx reg, and so that really does consume most of our time. But we are planning to move ahead with this and move ahead in the beginning of 2015. We will be working with stakeholders and affected sources, and some of the key issues that we expect to be working through are the additional modeling. We know both NRG and Raven have initiated their own modeling, and so at some point we need to all sit down and go through what their modeling shows, what our modeling shows, and work through that. There's also a piece that I didn't mention earlier, but a fairly significant federal program called the Mercury and Air Toxic Standard has been adopted by APA. It's gone back and forth in the courts. It appears to be moving forward. And we know that some of our own sources in Maryland are adding new controls because of that federal MATS standard. Those new controls are designed because it's a toxic standard. They're designed to deal with acid gases, but because when you control an acid gas, you also reduce SO2, we're going to see some benefits in terms of reducing SO2 from the MATS requirements. So we're going to be working through that. And finally, we need to work through the process of blending the SO2 requirements with the proposed requirements for the NOx standards. And just to give you a good example, what we did with the NOx standards is we have a hierarchy of controls, but one of the key things is that by 2020, we need to see higher end controls or maybe retirement of certain units. So we're going to need to build in the logic of the NOx program and link it with this SO2 requirement. We will be holding additional stakeholder meetings in 2015, and we hope to bring a regulatory action to act for approval in the first part of 2015. So that's my briefing. I'd be happy to take a few questions. Nothing urgent today, but I think when we get to taking an action, we wanted to start to get you guys thinking about this, get you looking at it. Be happy to take a few questions. Ross?
I just had a question about the numbers on the Morgantown slide. For all the other slides, if you go to the arrow, for all the other slides, your number on the arrow was, you know, a round off of the numbers in the table, but the 1,500 is one half of 3,000. Is there a simple explanation for why that is?
It's not per unit. It's per unit. There's two units.
Yeah, I know, but so for, if you go to Dickerson, it says total of 3 units. Go forward, please. And one more. Dickerson, total of 3, and he didn't divide 1,000 by 3.
It's just per unit number.
That's Ross, why I think small. This might be an error. We might need to fix that one for you.
Okay,
I think the Morgantown one has a glitch in it. So let us get back to you on that one.
Okay.
Morgantown does have 2 flues, 2 separate SAMs, so there are separate measurements, whereas Dickerson has 1 flue for 3 units, so it is 1 measurement for all 3. Maybe that's not true.
Okay. So,
any questions that I could actually answer?
Sorry.
I actually recall that as I was presented this.
Hey, it's great to have excellent support staff who are in the room.
That was actually Dave Kramer from NRG.
Yes.
Excuse me, is there any expectation that this process would ultimately be extended to other large stationary sources, large industrial sources?
Yes, there are several other sources we're going to be working with. Paper mill out in the western part of the state, and AES where you run is another source that's brought into this that we're working one-on-one, but I see these as the big issues.
Yeah. Okay. There are a couple of people signed up to talk about SO2. Would you
want
to do that now?
Sure. While we have a few minutes, who's signed up to talk about SO2?
Josh Berman. I'm assuming that probably David Smedic also.
Okay. So is it all right the council to take a few short comments since we're on this topic and we're still waiting for the chair to show up? Josh.
Thanks. Thanks so much. That was a helpful presentation. I just wanted to, I guess, reinforce from our perspective why these regulations are so important and why we would urge the council to continue to, urge MDE to act on this. As Ted mentioned, EPA ratcheted down in 2010 its ambient air quality standard for sulfur dioxide significantly, both in terms of shortening the averaging time and also lowering the standard. This was based on a growing body of compelling scientific evidence that exposure to sulfur dioxide, even in very short time scales, as short as 5 minutes, causes adverse human health effects. And I know many of you are much more expert than I am on this issue, but you know, SO2, among other things, is known to impair lung function, aggravate asthma, cause respiratory morbidity, and it's especially risky for children, the elderly, and asthmatics. And EPA, with its final rule, estimated that 2,300 to 5,900 premature deaths and 54,000 asthma attacks a year will be prevented by its revised ambient air quality standard. The problem is that this standard has been largely unimplemented. Historically, there were a number of large sources of sulfur dioxide. Tad mentioned the huge progress that's been made in cleaning up a lot of fuels that contain sulfur. That has greatly reduced the amount of sulfur dioxide that's produced from mobile sources, for instance. If you look today, sulfur dioxide almost overwhelmingly comes from burning coal, either through coal-fired power plants, which account for 44% of Maryland's sulfur dioxide emissions, or from coal-fired industrial boilers, which account for another 31%. And as Ted mentioned, it's significant that sulfur dioxide's direct health impacts are typically localized around these large sources. As you guys heard, Maryland remains home to a few of the most poorly controlled coal plants that remain in the eastern United States. Several units, not the energy units that were discussed, but several of the other units lack any add-on pollution controls for sulfur dioxide. At least one of those units is in the process of getting some control. But these units, especially the ones that have no add-on controls, are really significant outliers at this point in the U.S. coal fleet. And a number of these plants are located in proximity to schools, parks, and hospitals. Importantly, none of these plants is subject to an emission limit that ensures that its impacts on air quality are going to remain below the health protective standard that EPA has set. As Ted mentioned, last winter, MDE took some important steps to determine the emission rates that are necessary to ensure that these coal plants do not cause unsafe levels of sulfur dioxide in surrounding areas. And MDE incorporated those limits into a draft rule, which unfortunately has remained in draft form for the past 10 months. So I would urge you to call on MDE to continue with the schedule that Tad proposed and to actually, you know, to make this an action item at your next AQCAC meeting, because I think this is a really important regulation, and I do think that MDE right now has the information that it needs, and certainly within the time frame that Tad has identified is able to get the remaining information that it needs in order to move forward on this issue, which we think is really important. So thanks.
Thanks, Josh. Any questions for Josh?
I guess so. I have a question which is kind of to you, to Tad, and people who work with the numbers. At the beginning of Tad's talk, he showed the dramatic step down, in SO2 emissions, and those were in, I think, tons per quarterly.
Right.
These numbers are in tons or pounds per hour, and I can't do that math in my head. Are we looking at stricter reductions in the plants that already have had this step down? Is that what we're talking about here?
So, I mean, again, I don't want to speak for Ted, but our from the modeling that we did, which if you look at the numbers, they are typically fairly close. For many of the plants in Maryland, this would require no reduction in what they are actually able to achieve. You know, when they operate their controls, they're able to get levels that are consistent. You know, again, there may be some discussion about whether they can meet this every single hour or whether you need a slightly longer averaging time that addresses that. But basically, most of the units in Maryland, this regulation shouldn't cause them, you know, to force them to install anything additional. What it would do is it would ensure that they actually are required, you know, effectively required to run their controls and optimize way to stay below the numbers that emerge from the modeling as being necessary to protect. And then this is really an issue specifically for the few units in Maryland that just don't have the controls. And okay. So on an hourly basis, their emission rates are far higher now than all the ones that have, you know, scrubbers and other state-of-the-art controls.
What are those units?
So it's the two crane units, and then currently neither of the Wagner units has SO2 controls, though the larger of the two coal units at Wagner, and again, Ravensburg here now can talk more about
this. One of the slides.
Yes, a direct sorbent injection, I'm sorry.
Sorry. One of the slides I took out, because we're trying to keep it short, was a slide that talked about the difference between base load units and peaking units. So the way the power sector works these days is you have some units, because they're low cost, run a whole lot. Like the Morgantown unit is it runs a lot, and it runs its controls very well. So when we were doing the NOx piece, I think you guys remember, you had these big units with these very low daily emissions, even though they're generating. You have other units that are called on just on the days when the electricity is needed.
Right.
There was a
sure.
piece in those slides I was trying to avoid was the capacity factor, which is all units don't run as much as others. And so that's one of the dilemmas, is this is a short-term standard. So it is once again getting at this issue of emissions on peak days, which is a difficult issue.
Okay, thanks.
Diane, do we have anybody else that was?
I don't think anyone else has lined up for SO2.
No.
Okay, so what I would propose, since Kip is coming, I've told Kip is the vice chair, so we could actually move into the action-oriented agenda. So if it's already with the council, I'll hand the gavel back over to Kip. John will be here any moment, I'm told. We probably got 20 minutes of briefing, and then we'll have discussion and action. So, Diane, if it's all right, I'll hand off to Diane.
Yeah,
great.
Okay. Today we are bringing the cement manufacturing reg to you. Again, it's been a reg that's had a lot of minor adjustments to it and a lot of things happening in the outside world, additional regulations that apply to cement kilns while we've been trying to do this regulation. So we basically brought the reg to you in May and you approved the reg. It changed very little since then, except for the fact that there's been a federal NESHAP regulation with new monitoring requirements for cement plants. And basically, the new monitoring requirement requires them to put on a particulate matter continuous process monitoring system. And what that does is they will be running stack tests, and they will have the same particulate matter standard that they've always had. They will run the stack tests, and at the same time, they're looking at the electrical signal from a PM SEMS, continuous emission monitor. So they're not running the continuous emission monitor to monitor PM emissions. They are looking at this instrument to give them an electrical signal that matches the stack test when they have achieved the standard. Therefore, whenever they're operating and this particular continuous monitoring for particulate matter is going on and they're looking at the electrical signal, they can tell whether or not they are achieving the PM emission standards that they're required to. And basically, EPA has said that this is also an option that you can use instead of a continuous opacity monitoring. It's a little bit different monitor. The continuous opacity monitor really does monitor PM emissions that are coming out of their stack, but it's two different ways of using the continuous emission monitor for particulate matter. And we've been working very hard with EPA because, in general, this is a SIP revision to change one monitoring method to another monitoring method if they want to. And so whenever you make changes like that in the SIP, it's very difficult. So basically, what the reg does is we have two cement kilns in Maryland. It brings all the requirements that they have to do into one regulation. And that is what we wanted to do. We've noticed that over time our regs are getting more complex. They have little bits and pieces in several regs. And it's just easier for the sources if they can have them all in the same reg. So you can see here is an example where in two regs, they have opacity limits and monitoring requirements. So what happens is those requirements are mirrored here in this reg. So when you're a cement plant, you only need to go to one reg. The new requirements that you approved in 2014 were the new RAC limits that we wanted for NOx, which won't be effective until 2017, and also this ability for them to use a PM continuous process monitoring monitor, as well as at this point they will be able to use the COMS or the PM SEMS as a continuous process monitor. So the reason we've changed the RACs is because this is a new ozone standard. It's not new anymore, but we're still working on the RAC requirements for the 75 part per billion standard. There is another standard that EPA is proposing, somewhere between 65 and 70 parts per billion. We expect that over the course of this year, EPA is going to finalize that regulation and we'll be implementing that. But these standards were based on current technologies and economic feasibility. They were recommended by the Ozone Transport Commission after consideration of what the technologies are available to cement kilns. Our current standards are 2.8 pounds of NOx per ton of clinker for pre-calciner preheater kilns, and the long dry kilns have to meet 5.1 pounds of NOx per ton of clinker produced. And I think I changed the wrong one. It's just for long dry kilns. And we have one of each of those. The new standards will be 2.4 pounds of NOx for the pre-calcined or preheater kilns and the long dry kilns will have to achieve 3.4 pounds of NOx per ton of clinker produced. And what you find happening is that our long dry kiln has decided that with the new technologies that are available, that they want to move to a preheater, pre-calciner. So they will become a hybrid. They're investing about $90 million in upgrading their plant so that they will be able to meet the 2.4. Tiny dot down. 2.4 pounds. Holcim will be able to meet that by 2017 when their remodeling is finished. The reg just moves the particulate matter and the visible emission standards into this regulation. There's no change in the standards themselves. EPA was very felt it was very important that we maintain the ability to use the old visual observation method 9 monitoring method for visible emissions. There seems to be some question if it's not in the reg that maybe you wouldn't be able to use that, but they like to come and do visual inspections every once in a while. But the plants would be required to do the continuous monitoring of the particulate matter emissions using the particulate matter continuous emissions monitor as a process monitor, and then they could comply with the opacity standards by either monitoring with the PM, DPMS method, or by using their continuous opacity monitors. And if they use continuous opacity monitors, they must go ahead and follow the quality assurance procedures that was set forth in Chapter 31. Let's see, I think I've gone through all of the things that we've amended here. It just links them all again. EPA asked us to put, when we came to you in May, we did not have anything really except a reference to the PM continuous monitoring process method in our regulation. And they felt that they would like to see more of that spelled out. We didn't spell it out because it's spelled out in intricate detail in the NESHAPS regulation, but they asked us to put it in the reg. So that's one of the changes you see in the reg. There's more extensive regulatory language on that. And we've talked about all this and how difficult it is to change when you have an equivalent method that you're moving from one method to another. And it's easier if you're just changing the limit, because most of the time when we change our limits, we change the emission standard downward. So that's obviously a more restrictive standard. You're getting more reductions. Everybody is fine with that. But when you're just talking about changing from a continuous opacity monitor to using a process monitoring system, it's more difficult to figure out whether the methods are equivalent. And so one of the things that makes it easier is the fact that over time, we've managed to meet the fine particulate matter standard. In case we haven't bragged about this enough before, we've actually attained the 15 microgram per cubic meter standard that was set in 2012. We are also complying now with the new standard that was set. Actually, the new standard was set, and it's 12 micrograms per cubic meter. We met the old standard. We meet the new standard. We have sent our recommendation to be called an attainment area to EPA, and EPA has returned their 120-day letter that says, yes, we agree with your recommendation, and we're going to note that you are unclassifiable / attainment in the final designations, which is kind of interesting. I guess we're going to be making it because they're expected to do the final designations in December of this year, and they have approved our redesignation request for the Washington area already, and they proposed approval of the Baltimore and Washington County redesignation requests for the old standard. So we won't still be non-attainment for the old standard while we're moving into being attainment for the new standard. And we also have put in the requirement into the new reg to have NOx continuously monitored from the sniff zones. So basically, those are the changes that we've had, and you have approved it before. Most of the new stuff is really just a copying from the federal regulations, how to do the particulate matter, continuous process emissions requirements. Okay. Any questions?
Yeah, Diane, so was this just for a briefing? Or this is for action. Right?
Because the reg changed just a little bit, exactly. Have that extra language in it.
And just so you know, John won't be able to join us today. Mm. You can tell him, not 100%, but we will we'll keep going. Does the council have any questions?
Is he okay?
Is he okay?
I think it's a work-related thing that just keeps him from being here this morning. So.
And I'm not contagious.
You're not contagious?
No. We have positions just in case.
Right. So...
Larry, did you have a question?
Yes, so the level has, I'm a little confused. The level has already been approved in May, and all we're doing is changing the method of compliance?
Well, the NOx level was changed in May, and they measure that with a continuous monitor for NOx, and that monitoring method hasn't changed. But the particulate matter standard and the opacity standards, which haven't changed, the method that they're using to monitor those is changing.
Okay, so but are we changing levels or only changing methods of compliance?
In
this new proposed reg?
For the visible emissions and the particulate matter, we're just changing how you measure compliance with them.
And what levels are we changing in this one?
The NOx standards that you had previously approved.
That we had.
Diane, you've been working with the affected facilities.
Yes.
That we had previously approved, so we're not really changing it if we've previously
approved. It's really just the methods of measurement that you're looking at here.
Okay.
That are different.
That's the crux of what I'm getting at.
We didn't actually move forward with the reg because this NESHAP piece came out, and so we needed to incorporate that more effectively into the reg before we moved forward to actually adopt it.
Right,
so that's why you're seeing
things. Costs that are listed under economic impact, these look like all costs of adding more ammonia to the process,
and
not the cost of the monitoring itself.
Right. The fact sheet is the one that we used the last time. So in case anybody asks about what the costs were far as changing the NOx standard, those would be the costs for changing the NOx standard.
Okay.
And those are the same as they were in May. But
okay. Then the fourth paragraph, so I got that part. That's cost increase that really we incurred earlier.
Yes,
because of the level.
They've already done.
So now my question is, what's the additional cost from the new monitoring method? There's one sentence here that says it shifts monitoring costs from one instrument to another. Is that negligible cost, significant cost?
We did get the cost, but those cost data is coming in. And right now what we know is that the operating costs for the PM go up by 2 to 3 times, so they reach $30,000 for each year of operation because of compliance costs. That's what Diane mentioned.
Okay. So 30,000.
But the 30,000 is still from
for
NOx.
Not NOx. The PM correlation that you mentioned would cost $30,000 additional.
Because they have to do the stack test?
Yes, the stack test, and then correlated to the monitor.
This was Lehigh plant has provided some preliminary information recently, but we don't have the full information just yet.
The VSHAP requirement becomes effective in 2016. So it's a federal requirement, and they'll have to do it whether we do this. So I guess from a standpoint of this regulation, the cost for the change is negligible because they're required to do it by the feds. Whether we allow them to use one method or the other is immaterial. They still have to do this under federal NESHAP requirements.
The option we're providing is that for the opacity portion, they have the option to either remain with their comms.
But only for the opacity portion. For the
other
portion.
That's an option there.
Only for that.
Yes, for PM, under the federal rule, they're forced to go with the PM-CPMS method.
Right.
For continuous compliance. Okay.
And the reason, one of the reasons we didn't progress with the regulation before was that the cement kilns were adamant they wanted to take the continuous opacity monitors off when they had to do this NESHAP procedure. And now they're not sure. And so they have the option in the reg of doing either or. You know, so if they decide it's more beneficial for them to use a COM rather than the PM-CPMS method, they can do that.
All right. I have other questions, but I want to give other people a chance in case others have questions.
Does anybody else on the council have any other questions? Besides that, yeah, Ross.
So, for the actual words here, let's see. Am I in the right? I'm not even sure I'm in the right place here. So we're okay. I am in the right place. Okay, so for the words on, we have a three-page document here.
Mm-hmm.
If you can go to 05 where it says visible emission standards, there, thank you. Under B it says in areas 1, 2, 5, and 6. And then there's a 2, it says areas 3 and 4. What do those areas refer to?
Area 1 is Garrett, Washington and Allegheny County. Area 2 is Frederick County. Area 3 is the Baltimore non-attainment areas. You're used to it with Baltimore City, Anne Arundel County, Baltimore County, Howard, Hartford, and Carroll counties. Then Area 4 is Montgomery County and Prince George.
Okay, Diane, I'm sorry. So they're geographic areas. Why are we calling them out here? Because we only have a few of these in the whole state. Like, well, why are we going to this level of detail?
Because we haven't, I said we were trying to clean up the regs and make them easier to understand. But when we first started in the 70s, we made the areas of the state, maybe six areas. And in general, they corresponded at the time to non-attainment areas, where Area 3 was the Baltimore non-attainment area, which has a change. But Area 4 was Prince George's and Montgomery County. When the 1990 amendments were made, they made each of the non-attainment areas, the boundaries coincide with the metropolitan statistical areas. So they added Frederick, Charles and Calvert to the Washington non-attainment area, and it's got some Virginia and D.C. too. But so it didn't actually correlate anymore. But because these Roman numeral areas are spread throughout our regulations from long ago, it would be very difficult to actually make them conform to the non-attainment areas we have today. But these really old standards, like the visible emission standards, which we've had since the 70s, they're all done based on the original geographic areas.
Okay.
And I'm sure they're noted. It is in COMAR somewhere. I'm sure it's in the federal regulations, too, because they will sometimes use those.
Okay, definitions. But some of these areas don't have cement manufacturing in them at all, right?
Right, but they, but it's corresponding to the visible emissions
okay,
standards. Sure.
Carroll and Washington County are the only two plants we have.
Okay, and then my other question is, why do we have these strange dates in here, January 17th, 1972, in February 21st, 1971, what's the significance
they're
of that?
They're holdover from, these are old regulations. We're extracting information from a regulation that was written in 26-11-06 in 1972, years and years and
okay.
years ago. We're simply moving a regulation that hasn't changed and putting it into a new chapter of all the things that conform to cement plants.
Okay.
These things aren't changing, they're just...
Okay. What for the cement plants that we're talking about, when were they built?
They're
probably in the 70s sometime,
wouldn't
you think? Yeah, maybe. Wholesome, they were not built in the 70s. They were existing. They were both, I think, pre-existing when we got the Clean Air Act. And in I think around 2002, 2003, Lehigh upgraded and modernized their plant. And so they ended up with a whole bunch of different limits that apply to them because they were a different kind of plant. And this is the first upgrade for Holcim they've had in a long time. They've been a long dry kiln. Now they're modernizing. So that's why. And the geographic areas are there because, as a whole, the visible emission standards apply to everybody.
Okay.
All the different. But places, and that's why whether or not you had a cement kiln didn't matter.
Okay, so what Randy has up there for 6A1, we say it's 2,000 ppm if it was constructed before January 17th, 1972, or 500 ppm after that, and so that's a factor of four difference based on when it was constructed, and I don't understand what we're even dealing with, because I don't know if these plants were constructed before or after that key date.
Wayne, can I put you on the spot? And I think that these guys, with their current requirements, meet much lower standards on a regular basis than the 2,000 or the 500. Is that true?
Yeah.
Right. They have scrubbers on.
Yeah.
I don't even think they're going to have a problem with the new SO2 standards.
So why are we asked to approve?
To be honest, we wouldn't even be bringing this portion of the reg for you to be voting upon because it's already a COMAR standard. Nothing is changing with this. We're really asking for you to really look at 04 and 05, the visible emission standards portion and the PM monitoring. The rest of these are already approved, consistent Maryland regulations. It's a housekeeping exercise. We're moving them into a new chapter, but we're not changing the standard or proposing anything new.
And they're in SIP. So if we took them out, even though they're meeting better standards, we'd have to go through this whole thing of writing a 110L demonstration for them. And it just isn't worth the exercise because they're already performing much lower than these things are requiring them to do.
Okay,
here.
So you'd like us to look at 04 and 05?
Primarily.
That's where the new stuff is.
Okay.
But I sort of share.
Because we brought this. This is probably like the fourth time you've seen this, and I think we probably explained that a lot of this is housekeeping in previous presentations that you've already approved, but these are the two sections that are changing that are new for your areas.
I do share Russ's sort of overall goal to simplify things if they can be simplified. But I recognize that it creates more process for you.
It's baby steps. This is a step, I think, maybe at some point we'll address areas one of these years. I don't know.
Maybe one day all the areas, maybe one day we'll just have perfect air quality.
The difficulty is these areas are mentioned throughout the chapters. There are 35 chapters, and if you make one change, you have to change all the chapters at the same time. So that's the reason why.
Maybe, but it seems like you could delete language that's plans constructed before a certain date if there are none. So anyway.
Exactly. And then the other thing that you're risking here is what we have on the board for 6A1. If someone builds a cement plant tomorrow and it, you know, emits 400 ppm, then they can say, well, I'm in compliance with your rule.
Then you get into new source performance standards at the federal level that they have to meet.
Okay.
So, although EPA, every time we put a reg like this up there, they will say, oh, you don't have a number for the long wet kiln, and we don't have a long wet kiln. And under the NSPS, no long wet kiln would be able to be built today because they wouldn't be able to meet those new standards. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Does the council have any other questions, Larry? Did you have any more?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, doesn't have to be long, I hope. But I just want a little more confidence because we're using the word parametric monitoring. That feels kind of vague to me. A parameter can be flow. It can be temperature. I don't know what it is. Could you give us a little more confidence in what this method is?
Milliamps.
Yeah, but milliamps is a surrogate for something else that the instrument is measuring.
Particulate matter.
Wait, but let me finish my question. So what exactly are the parameters in the process that are being measured? Can you give us a little more confidence in that? And you said it's based on an EPA method. Is the EPA method specific to those parameters, or are we sort of making a new method in the state?
No, it's exactly like the federal method.
Okay.
And they're measuring milliamps.
It's not milliamps.
Related to PM. Milliamps connected to the PM.
Oh, I was trying to pull up the actual niche app, which I can't connect.
It's milliamps from.
From the monitor, based on the PM load that has been measured through a stack test.
Right.
But what exactly is the instrument monitoring? That is, its output is milliamps. What is it monitoring?
It's monitoring the loss of light intensity.
Okay.
And relating it to the load of PM that is coming out of the stack.
So it's really an opacity monitor.
But it is taking the electrical signal for the PM and connecting the two.
No, yes. It's a transducer, transducing it's opacity.
It's a small slipstream of the stack. It's not an opacity monitor across the stack.
Then what is it?
It's just a small slipstream. You know, it just goes into the analyzer itself and measures the opacity of that sample.
Okay.
So, and they're just trying to relate that to the opacity that's coming out of the stack.
So it's taking a little side stream.
Yeah.
And measuring opacity of that.
Yeah.
And is it going after PM 2.5 or total PM?
Total.
It's a total PM. And one of the problems with the PM continuous emission monitors were that using them for opacity was that it doesn't measure all of the PM that a continuous opacity monitor does. The continuous opacity monitor does a better job than the PM SEMS. Especially on the fine particles. And so that's why EPA would never allow them just to switch over to the PM SEMS when you run it as a PM SEMS. But now you're running it as a parametric monitoring system for the milliamps, and you're calibrating the milliamps with the stack test. So once you achieve the standard in the stack test, the milliamps that you've recorded from the monitor during the stack tests, you know, there's a small range, and you're allowed to be within that range. And when you go outside the range, you have to do it. It's based on a 30-day rolling average. But you have to keep a pretty tight grip on those milliamps then.
Whether this helps at all or not, there is an offhand statement made in the federal NESHAP, where it's EPA's opinion that the PMCPMS method is preferable over comms for opacity. They believe it's a more modern, a better approach to measuring opacity.
And is the PCMS method more precisely defined in the federal reg?
Yes. and I was trying to pull that up.
All right.
And I didn't bring a copy.
And where is the reference to that more precise
definition
in our reg?
It's in the
CFR. Compliance 04A3, compliance with the PM standards, shall be determined by a stack test.
Yeah. Right.
63, 61, 34, 9, 35, those are the references. Right. And when we finally go publication with this and we create a technical support document, the actual NESHAP rule will be an appendix to that. It will be part of the document that we'll compose.
And that rule, that CFR rule, actually describes what this CPMS is?
Yes, in much more detail.
All right, and then the last question.
Two or three pages, I think.
All right, so it's in stuff we're not seeing. Okay. The last question I have is, it says there's no impact on small businesses. Who owns these plants if they're not small businesses?
Oh, I think both of those are national corporations.
Okay.
Lehigh and Holston are both national corporations.
All right.
And dozens of plants throughout the country.
All right, and if we're increasing the cost of these two plants, what are neighboring states doing?
The neighboring states, at least Pennsylvania, has also adopted regulations for the RAC standards that are comparable to ours. And I'm not sure whether the cement kilns there wanted to take their cones off or not, but they are also subject to the NESHAP requirements. So, you know, those are federal requirements.
So we're not going to disadvantage Maryland sites and shift business.
No, and it's in the ozone transport region. It's Pennsylvania and New York that have the cement kilns and Maryland.
And there are additional requirements that the two plants are having to do for other reasons that they're even having to go to the levels below what we have in our regulations. So really our regulations have little to no impact. There are other mitigating reasons that they have to do other things. We're just trying to clean up our regs to have a more modernized RAC approach for NOx and follow along with the requirements that are coming out of NESHAP as far as monitoring is concerned.
All right, I have no more.
Does anybody else on the council have any questions? Ted, did anybody sign up to speak? Did anybody want to speak on this particular issue?
No, I'm actually kind of surprised. None of the cement representatives are here. But we have talked to them endlessly on the phone about this. So I think that's.
So you've had stakeholder review with you quite a bit, which is always important. Okay, do I hear a motion then? Any other discussion before we do that? If not, do I hear a motion? Any second?
Second.
Second. All those in favor? Raise your hand, please.
And,
hold on for a second.
I believe Kevin is on the phone, too.
Kevin's on the
phone. Council member, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm here.
Kevin, how do you vote?
I'm in favor.
Okay. Any opposed?
Did you guys keep the count?
Yes.
Okay.
Any abstentions? Okay. Thanks, Diane.
Thank you.
Good. Okay, so.
We have another briefing in one of stage two.
Okay. Two.
You shouldn't have made me look at this. All the commenters are on stage two.
I know.
Yeah, I know.
Sometimes I get weird.
So we do have a regulation we'd like you to review and if possible act on today, but if you need to take some more time, we can do that. There's no driving federal requirement to move ahead right away. We're doing this primarily because we've got a lot of pressure from the private sector to move forward and do this. But if we need to take a little more time, we can certainly do that. So, stage two, I'll start off with my favorite story. Who remembers George Ferrari? George Ferrari was my original boss. I was a young, skinny kid. We were doing stage two. This is the early 90s. And we went down to do a demonstration of stage two. And the vice chair of the Economic Matters Committee was there to do the demonstration, pulled out the stage two nozzle and went all down into that. So these are the nozzles on the gas pumps. They've evolved over time, so you don't even notice them. They were big and clunky 15 years ago. Now you hardly notice them. But technologies have evolved, and we need to make some changes. So I'd like to quickly go through a little bit of the stakeholder process we've been going through for quite a while, a little bit of background, and then a real brief summary of the amendments. So what's the bottom line? I mean, basically what we're doing is we're phasing out the requirements of the Stage 2 vapor recovery program because onboard canisters have now become prevalent in the fleet and are actually achieving equal or greater benefits than the old collection system at the nozzle. So we've seen a technology change over the past 20 years where the equipment in the car, the onboard collection system, now collects the vapors, where in the old days, the stage two at the pump. So the consumer saves the money from less gas. Anyway, so that's really what's going on here. This is a fairly straightforward exercise. And there are huge cost savings to Maryland businesses. We've been working extensively with stakeholders on this for almost 2 years. It's a difficult program for us because we record some of the highest ozone air pollution in the eastern part of the country. Matter of fact, the Harford County monitor still records perhaps the highest in the east. We're the only area designated as moderate in the east. Texas and California have some moderate. So this is a fairly difficult one for us to move away from. So we spent a lot of time making sure that while we move away from the Stage 2 program, we're not going to make our ozone problem worse. Hard to see some of these numbers, but we actually worked with the private sector. They gave us their own numbers on cost savings. So these are the numbers coming from the Maryland business community, and it just shows you how much savings there will be based upon an owner's system. So a very large set of gasoline stations with lots of pumps and almost $9 million in savings over the next 10 years from not having to run and maintain the stage two equipment down to a smaller network where there's still about $500,000 in savings. So
does each one of those lines represent a different operator?
That's exactly what it is. So there's a big cost savings here, and that's why we've been under some pressure to move forward and move forward quickly. A little bit of the background. The bottom line is technology has changed. We're reflecting that in a regulation change. But in July 2011, the EPA released a federal policy that said that because onboard canisters are now in widespread use, the states may begin to eliminate their stage two programs. They required us to follow guidance and figure out how and when, and there's a big technical piece I'll mention in a second. But the bottom line is we can move away from stage two. We've reached a point where the benefits from the stage two system are small, and over time will have become negative because of their relationship with the onboard equipment. Right now, the Stage 2 program is in a Maryland regulation and is part of the federal state implementation plan. So to move away from Stage 2, we literally need to amend the reg and then have that new amended reg be included as part of the SIP, basically eliminating the Stage 2 requirements. The SIP, everybody asked me for a copy of the SIP, and I think they want a nice little neat thing. I think the SIP is what? Probably a set of file cabinets that would cover that full wall. It's just a set of regulatory actions and actions that are ever since the 70s. It's a huge package, and the Stage 2 program is part of the SIP. It's a regulation that's been made part of the SIP.
did do a comprehensive technical analysis. If folks want to read it, it's out on our website. Basically follows the EPA guidance, looks at the way the fleet evolves in Maryland and how the benefits from stage two become smaller and smaller over time. We did spend quite a bit of time discussing the analysis with the stakeholders, but the bottom line is, in the EPA analysis, 2017 is the key date for equivalency in Maryland. In other words, in 2017, the onboard canisters, the benefits from the onboard canisters, that way the small incremental benefit from the stage two program. I'm not going to go through the details, but this is really the regulation with three simple bullets. If you're building a new service station, you do not need to add the stage two equipment after March 6, 2014. Period. If you're an existing gasoline dispensing facility service station, you may decommission those stage two equipment after January 1, 2017. If you are a gasoline dispensing facility that's undergoing a major modification, in other words, there's a definition of major modifications, you're changing things, you may begin to decommission the stage two system at that modified station when you're going through that modification. We don't want people to do a lot of work between now and 2017 and have to do a lot of additional work after 2017. So that's really it in a nutshell. Now, there's a couple other pieces I wanted to highlight. We have a lot of folks that are ready to speak. I think there's some concerns over some of the other pieces. So let's go through that. Oh, there's specific language in the reg that talks about how to decommission the equipment. And there is a nationally recognized way to do this coming from the Petroleum Equipment Institute. It's embodied in COMAR 26-10-10, so it's not just as easy as pull the pumps out. There's the underground storage tanks. It's actually a fairly complicated process, maybe simplifying too much, but it's pretty standard within the industry. I think everybody this is the point most folks agree on. Some of the things that we're also including in the reg, which we think are very reasonable, but we can have some discussion on it. There are some emerging technologies coming to continue to reduce emissions from gasoline pumping operations. What we propose in the rule is that if these new technologies are certified by the California Air Resources Board, and in 2020 we've been designated as a moderate or greater non-attainment area for the new ozone standard, then these new technologies would then be required in 2020. So moderate and above is probably a term that needs a little bit of description. When you're designated under the Clean Air Act, you can be designated as marginal. And when EPA designates you as marginal, what they're saying is you don't need to do anything. You're gonna glide into attainment. When you're designated as moderate, you're expected to adopt a new plan, to have new control programs. That's why we've been asking you to approve a lot of these things over the last year. The Baltimore area is currently designated as moderate, even though we're actually seeing very, very low ozone levels this year in the Baltimore area. So the new technologies only apply if they've been certified by the California Air Resources Board and we are designated as moderate or above. And there's a phase-in in 2020 to deal with the transition of the technology. The two technologies are dripless nozzles, who's pumped their gas and wondered why that drip happens at the end of the process. I think we've all done that, right? You sort of try to keep it up closed mostly, but so there are dripless nozzles that are evolving. Again,
really being sort of pushed in California. Some other states in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic areas are looking at them, Delaware, New Jersey. There's also low permeation hoses. Believe it or not, the hose at your gas pump, the gasoline, and the fumes from the gasoline slowly permeate through the rubber and release very small amounts, but over time. So there are lower permeation hoses under development. We brought a rule back to you guys maybe 3 or 4 years ago, which was gasoline canisters. And one of the requirements for the new canisters was low permeation canisters. So this is the same kind of thing. Again, these are evolving technologies, and we thought phasing them in over a reasonable time frame made some sense. The other thing we're pushing in the rule is that the last bullet. The way we got structured is that when you run a service station, you have to replace the nozzles and the hoses as part of maintenance anyway. So what we proposed is that we wouldn't be saying on a specific date, you must have these. What we'd be saying is as part of that normal cycle you go through to upgrade your nozzles and the hoses, at some point you need to phase in the new technologies. And this is something we've been doing a long time. We can't guarantee it, but we're expecting that by the 2020 timeframe, the dripless nozzles and the low permeation hoses will sort of be standard equipment in the industry. They are new now, and I think there's been some concern over them, and I think we'll hear a little bit about that. But that's what we're trying to do and how we're trying to include that piece. The other piece is that we have had several large owner groups talk to us about electric vehicle charging and linking it to stage two. And so there are companies in Maryland who are moving forward with installing electric vehicle charging equipment at their stations. So we've included a voluntary option. Nobody's required to do this totally voluntarily, but if a company wants to move forward with installing electric vehicle charging equipment, then they can decommission earlier. They're no longer subject to the 2017 date. They may decommission earlier, so there's an incentive in the reg to encourage investment into electric vehicle charging. Totally different briefing, but as part of our work on the ozone standard, as part of our work on climate change, we see the transition of the electric vehicle fleet as a really important thing over the next 10 and 20 years. So. Again, totally voluntary. Nobody's required to do this. Only companies that want to move down this path can take advantage of it. But I think there's some questions about it. Our schedule is we brought it to ACAC today. We'd like to move ahead with an approval if that's possible. But again, there's no federal deadline on this. We're just doing it as quickly as we can so that we reduce the burden on the affected facilities. And what we'd like to do is move ahead with an adoption process that would end up with the rule being effective somewhere in the June timeframe. And that's it. I'd be happy to take a couple questions, but I also know we have at least 3 or 4 speakers who wanted to comment on this. John?
Ted, I think you mentioned in an earlier council meeting, and you touched on it a little while ago, that there was some evidence that operating the two systems, the onboard system and the stage two together, might actually be detrimental. Is there a mandatory decommissioning provision date under the EPA provisions for changeover that says after this date we want all the stage two systems out of operation?
No. Matter of fact, it's totally up to the state. What there is a requirement for, though, is if you decide not to move away from stage two and you create the increase in VOC because of the inconsistency, the state's required to make that up in its SIP. It has to adopt a new control program. So there is the states are held. Their feet are held in the fire through the SIP to find additional measures, but there's no mandate. Matter of fact, some states like California are not moving away from stage two.
How strong is that evidence that there's a sort of a counterproductive aspect of having?
Yeah, I think
systems?
There is. I think the evidence is pretty strong that there is at some point you actually increase emissions by having the two systems play out together. But there's also a piece that I struggle with, which is. People don't just fill up their cars at gas stations. They fill up their
boat tanks and their gasoline tanks, and so we are losing. So there are some things Maryland is going to have to do to make up for a shortfall. But 2017 is the date that said it's become so small that the benefits outweigh those benefits. So. But I think it's pretty strong. You're saying, am I right on that, or Randy? Am I right on that? It's pretty strong evidence that there's a negative. At some point, there's a negative between the onboard and the stage still.
It is, and EPA estimates that the range is between 1 to 10%, you know, due to the interference, non-compatibility it is called. But at the same time, there are technologies that mitigate that part also. And like Tad mentioned, California continues to use stage 2 because of toxics benefits. So there is evidence, you know, and there have been a lot of studies that have gone into much greater detail with respect to what are the optimum choices, and like Tad mentioned, there are cost implications, but there are emerging technologies that compensate for the costs as well. And it is just the fact that, you know, it's not common knowledge. It has not been fully accepted with respect to the quantity, the effectiveness of the technologies, and the cost. There is no uniform level that all states can look at, you know, data, for instance, to review and come to a conclusion. That is why OTC is reviewing it, and other states are also struggling through this process.
What about that issue that Hussein just mentioned, the HAPS control versus VOC control?
That's an issue that we've looked at. We think that you do get some HAPS benefits by continuing on with stage 2, but they're small.
What percentage of our fleet is pre-onboard control? And the other question I would have is, how many stations are there in Maryland where there are filling station attendants that do the filling of the gas tank?
The percentage with OR, VR is above 80% right now in Maryland. So we have passed the mandate in the Clean Air Act, which required 75% of penetration of ORVR. And Maryland did a detailed analysis. It's called Maryland Analysis. It's also on the web, where for every year there's an estimate with respect to what percentage of ORVR vehicles are anticipated in Maryland. And you will see there that by 2020, 95% of the vehicles in Maryland will have ORVR, and nationwide also. But Maryland, because of its specific fleet, would have a slightly higher percentage than the national average. So it will reach 96 to 97% of ORVR penetration, which essentially means that up to 5% of gasoline would not be covered by ORVR vehicles. And like Ted was pointing out, that amounts to close to 100 million gallons being dispensed without vapor recovery, which is not a small amount, you know. If you consider other industries, we have standards when you transfer 5 gallons from one container to another. So this is a big quantity of gasoline that goes without vapor recovery, but that was part of the Clean Air Act.
But decreasing all the time.
Yes.
More vehicles come.
Yes, but after a certain point, there are only vehicles with ORVR, but also their classification of vehicles that will never have ORVR. And also, you know, motorcycles, boats, and lawn mowers do not have anything for vapor recovery, and you're using a container to fill up the gasoline. So those vapors are always emitted. And the efficiency of ORVR is close to 98%. So there's a 2% loss of vapor from ORVR also.
The other thing I didn't mention, but as the science of ozone has evolved over the past 20 years, a lot of the ozone policy was actually born in California. And the way their meteorology and topography work, VOC reductions perhaps provide significant or meaningful benefit in California, where it appears that the science in the eastern part of the country is driven by NOx reductions, or what's really driving the ozone down. And part of that is that Ronald Reagan was right. The VOC inventory is so dominated by biogenic or non-man-made hydrocarbons, trees and crops that that VOC is it's important for it helps, but it is not. When we started to drive NOx down, we saw ozone drop dramatically. We've never seen that kind of change with VOC reductions.
What my other question was, how many filling stations are there in Maryland where there is an attendant? Because that they, unlike those of us who pump our own gas, if you filling station attendants get it several times an hour, not once a week, and have of course been characteristically the target population for the toxicity of gasoline.
I don't have that off the top of my head. Hussein, or maybe somebody,
Maryland does
maybe
not have
Kirk or Ellen would have that.
They're almost gone. I only yes. There's only one in my circle.
Boy, where?
I just wondered if there was
the same one.
In New Jersey.
New Jersey.
They have special regulations they have to follow. But most of all, our members, if you toot your horn, they'll come in and pump the gas for you. But that's really
Sarah, you both had questions. Sarah, why don't you go first?
Okay. Quick question about the electric vehicle charging option. Is there any problem with having electric vehicle fast charging alongside gas station pumps? Are there any
danger?
I don't know. That's why.
One thing to say is that there is a mandated location of where they need charging stations.
Okay.
And Tad did mention we had a very healthy and robust stakeholder process. As part of that stakeholder process, we had a five-meeting series of an electrical vehicle work group session. And through that, it was pretty much recommended and encouraged that these partnerships be made, that these EV stations be located off-site. We realize, and the industry as well realizes, it's a competing factor in some sense. They're trying, you know, it doesn't make much sense to have an EV station sometimes be placed at a gas station, but it does make sense to maybe be sited at a grocery store, a shopping center, or a mall, and that's what I think a number of stations are doing. But there are stations out there that have EV stations parallel with their gas pipes. There's a dedicated pad set up off to the side.
Do you know of any in Maryland?
Scott, are you aware of any? Any EV stations in Maryland that gas station?
They are not exactly at gas stations, but very in close proximity to gas stations. You know, just like maybe 200 feet from a gas station, you'll find charging.
We had the person who presented, we had a series of presenters come during our stakeholder process. One was from Nissan, another was from another gas station facility, but they did have pictures that they showed that did have the gas stations and an EV charging station within the same facility, so we know they exist.
So again, anything like this has to go through a siting safety process, and one of the reasons this is totally voluntary is that some sites are appropriate, others are not, and appropriate is you have to have a fairly large footprint, you have to have the ability to do this in a safe way, and from a business perspective, you know, it has to be in an area where you're actually going to see some business because of it, so.
I'm not sure who's going to sit for a period of time at a gas station to get their car charged.
That's right.
Well, these fast chargers can give you a pretty good
20 minutes.
Pretty good charge in about 10, 20 minutes.
15 minutes,
yeah. So these are
what kind of vehicle.
I'd mention this. These are the DC fast chargers that are, you know, and there are folks who have begun to do this, including their business model, and maybe not linked to pumping gas. Maybe it's linked to coffee and
Wawa, yeah.
Wi-Fi hotspots in
Yeah, I just wanted to respond a little bit to that. Well, there's a whole body of code and safety regulation that we don't see here. NFPA and National Electric Code is one of their documents about explosion prevention and so on. So I don't know the specifics for it, But I'm sure somebody from the industry can tell us there's lots of regulation for explosion prevention.
Yeah, NFPA 70E has most of the electrical safety type things.
Okay. And we do have a few commenters.
Oh, yeah. How many? Any other questions?
Yeah, quick question and then sort of an open-ended one. You mentioned the phase-in in the presentation. I don't see it in the reg. I just see that it says that you've got to get it in by 2020.
It's two phases. One is new stations may build.
I'm sorry, phase in for low permeation and dripless nozzles.
Oh, 2020.
I'm seeing in K and L that it's 2020. I don't see the phase in where it says on a replacement cycle put the new hose in. I see it as a strict requirement for 2020.
Do you have that in there, Randy?
No, it's not changing.
Okay. Well, we probably need to fix the reg.
Well, no, I mean, I think 2020 is fine if that's a hard date and people are going to replace them every 3 years anyway.
Yeah.
And the other is more of an open-ended question, and I think we've talked about it before. Perhaps having one pump that handles that's specific to with vapor recovery for portable containers and vehicles without onboard. I know it's complicated.
It does maintain it. It requires the maintenance of the entire system, though, and for just that one pump. So just from an economic perspective, it would. I understand it from an air quality perspective. It makes sense, but it would require that the whole system be maintained.
But
just minimal use.
As a regulatory option that has not been pursued anywhere else, you see. But we can find out what the feasibility is with respect to having just on one dispenser the vapor recovery option. It will have to be communicated properly to the public, you know, with respect to where they can go with the containers.
Mm-hmm.
And that needs to be resolved with the stakeholders as well.
Let me ask a question. Was it my understanding you said that you can't just turn off a stage two vapor recovery system? There's not a switch. You can just, you have to change out the pumps. You have to dig out the tanks.
No, there is an option to do that as well, to turn the switch off.
Right.
And
just turn it off and let it
be. Goes off. But what you do after that is what Dad was pointing out with respect to the decommissioning procedures. You see, you cannot just leave these pipes open because there's constant exchange of air and vapors going on.
Correct.
So they'll be emitted into the air regardless, you know, if you do not cap them. And that procedure is not very cheap. It costs $10,000 to $11,000. So New York has this policy for several years where they have allowed stations to decommission stage two. And the statistic has shown that only 15% of all the stations took advantage of it. You know, in other words, they continued with vapor recovery because they would have had to go through a procedure where they have to ensure that all the vent lines and everything, you know, that recovers vapors are capped off, which requires a capital expense.
But based on, I mean, at $9.5 million, if I'm that particular guy and I've got 156 stations, I might do the math and it might be beneficial to decommission everything.
Sure.
By the way, the council, we'll take another question, but we'll come back after we hear the other. We can come back for additional questions and discussion. Yes?
I think I know the answer to this, but I don't really see it spelled out. The electric vehicle charging station, the number of stations owned, and then the number of required charging stations. For example, greater than 100 required is 11. That is per station, isn't it? Or is it total?
It's per owner system.
So another, if they had 100 stations, they only have to have 11 total of all?
Yes. So, and again, you've got to remember, a small station without a big footprint, you're just never going to put it. You're just not going to do
so
it.
So they have 100 stations.
But a great big piece of property and a new build in Montgomery County, that's an interesting business opportunity for some businesses. And that's why this is totally voluntary. We did have a piece earlier where MDE was pushing that this be a more mandatory requirement. It just, for a variety of reasons, we ended up having it be totally voluntary.
I just want to be sure. So they have 100 stations. They can take those 11 charges and spread it among the 100?
Or anywhere.
So that there would be then 89 that didn't have it?
Yes.
Okay. It's I somehow thought it might have been per station, but that's...
No, for, that's not per station. From our overarching environmental goal perspective, we are really, Maryland is amongst the leaders trying to evolve our infrastructure to support the transition of the electric vehicle fleet more quickly than slowly. It just is a really important thing for the future ozone issues as well as the climate change issues. So we're pushing that in many arenas. This is just one area we had a discussion of how to incentivize it.
Okay, why don't we hear from these speakers? If you could, please, we'll do what we've done in the past. Yes, go ahead.
So the conditional obligations in 2020, what happens if EPA hasn't actually finalized designations for the 2020? Like, is the condition on something else, or does it wait until the EPA? How does the regulation deal with that?
It would have to wait.
Okay, so it's based on whenever, 2024, whenever EPA finalizes the designation for the forthcoming ozone standard.
Yeah, and part of that is, we've been making a lot of progress with ozone. Ozone has been our problem child, and this summer, a lot of it had to do with some very, very strange, cool weather, but we recorded the lowest levels for ozone we've seen in 30 years. And so we know a new standard is coming. We guess that we will be designated as non-attainment, whether it's marginal or moderate, we get to see. So yeah, it's contingent on continuing to have a difficult ozone problem to solve.
Okay. All right. First of all, I'll apologize if I get the name wrong one because I don't have my glasses on. Senator Ray, difficult. So let's first hear, and please, if you could keep it to 3 or 4 minutes, we'd all appreciate it. Kirk McCullen.
Kirk McCullen from the Service Agency Association. On decommission, we're not against electric charging stations. We just don't think they belong in service stations. They belong in destination points, like interstates, workplaces, malls, places where people go to. They want to spend a little time, whether it be a half hour or whether it be 30 minutes. I don't know. I don't want to set a service station. I would want 31 years. I don't want to set in a service way around much of a car charge. And we know it's not mandatory, but it's a character to put out there for us that my small guy, the number one station, they're struggling to make ends meet in small business right now. It's a character they can't reach. But yet the big guys that can spend 40 to 50 by state's estimates, that's what electric charging station will cost, $40,000 to $50,000 to install. They can afford to spend that money to get there, even though they don't know whether they're going to ever get it back or not, but it lets them go forward. And so we just feel the small guys are a distinct disadvantage here. And with the stage two, what it is right now, it can be up to a 10% disadvantage to be operating stage two at the same time with the ORVR. The ORVR is, according to EPA, more efficient than stage two. Does a better job. And we heard states say that the saturation point is well over 80% in vehicles right now. I just looked around the parking lot, walked around before I come in here, got here a little early, looked around. I couldn't find a pre-98 car. No, I mean, I just...
You came before I did.
Yeah.
85.
So, we just think that it's going to cost anywhere between $7,000 to $11,000, $12,000 to decommission. We agree with the regulations the way it is to decommission the protocol and everything to do that. But it's going to cost that amount of money. If they made this regulation effective today, it's going to take 4 or 5 years for this to all happen. Dealers, as their requirements go, as they need new hoses, nozzles, as they need new pumps for their, as they need new air pumps for their gas pumps, they will replace. But it's not going to be right away, so it's going to be a slow process to get to that point where they get to the stage two.
2017. And as far as California regulations go, California uses a balance system with stage two. I think 99% of rental stations are airbag systems. They're not compatible. Balance is compatible. So what California does with their stuff has nothing to do with stage two in Maryland. Two separate systems altogether. And that's one of the big problems of these nozzles. And low permeation hoses, I don't know. There's none made yet. We don't know a cost on them. We don't know a cost on a nozzle. No one can tell us anything because no one's using them. If that's needed in 2020, then we ought to address that in 2020. We shouldn't be addressing the day of the hypothetical. That's all that's saying.
Thank you very much. Any questions of this gentleman before we move on? Okay. Thank you very much. Ellen Valentino?
Thanks. My name is Ellen Valentino. I represent the Mid-Atlantic Petroleum Distributors, and we concur with Mr. McCullough's comments. Two very specific points. We hope we don't move forward with this regulation. We think that it's the wrong direction, and we hope to continue to try to work with MDE to move in what we think is the right direction, and that is the quickest removal of stage two vapor recovery nozzles. The proposals or the regulation here today, we think, has just two very specific flaws in it that concern us. And we've been very clear that, again, we believe this is not a cost savings for our stations. And that's where I think we're really having a trouble coming to terms with MDEs. We see it as a relief to an extremely cost burden to how we've had to operate for over 20 years here. These have been very expensive systems. And those expenses have to be built into our prices and our business decisions here in the state. So we're not having a windfall of a tremendous amount of money should this regulation be repealed. That's not the case whatsoever. We have had to absorb these costs, not just internally, but also push them through to the consumers of the state, because as you can see, they are enormous. The issue of connecting the EV charging system and agenda to the decommissioning of stage two is wrong and unfair. There's absolutely no correlation. And to think that it would be okay to mandate on the private sector the installation of an EV charging system at a competitor like a grocery store, to me is something I think gives tremendous pause, and we reject it and have from the beginning, and we've been very clear on that. The issue of this speculatory regulation of dripless nozzles and permeated hoses, we have absolutely no idea the cost or the effectiveness of these type of products soon to be in the market, maybe. And to put that cost and that lag in 6 years out, which over the next administration, additionally, to a 2020 non-attainment scenario that comes down in Maryland, I think it's not just very wrong for us, very wrong, it's very bad public policy, but I think it's wrong for the environment. Why would you want to hook equipment that you know nothing about, that isn't in the marketplace, there's actually no data other than what the equipment manufacturers may present, and we all understand that, as to the effectiveness these may have on reaching an attainment scenario here in Maryland. Expensive regulations need to be made in real time. That's where we stand. As far as I know, Tad mentioned, you may hear dealing with drips on the ground and the impact on the environment. There is a lot of, I'm going to use water under the bridge on that, a lot of data and studies that have been done. I know there's one here you may hear about that complete or in the works. I will forward to this committee the EPA studies on this themselves. This is not a new issue. It's been in existence since the beginning of EPA and gasoline stations. So we urge you not to move forward. We think it's time that Maryland move forward as quickly as possible to relieve small businesses of this burden, and we hope you not adopt this regulation or agree to move it forward at this time. Thank you.
Thanks, Ellen. Does anybody have any questions?
I have a question for either of you two.
Sure.
So
well stated. I understand where you're coming from. So if we repeal this, or we say we don't approve of this, then doesn't that mean the status quo persists? So you just, your stations still have to keep the stage two recovery in place?
No, no. What it means is that we get back together with NBE and try to come forward with regulation. That's what it means. This doesn't end this today. I mean, by year 2017, stage two is of no benefit or potential harm to the environment here. No, okay. It just puts us in a place, really, to be quite candid, to urge the state to move forward with the decommissioning stage two.
Okay, so,
sorry.
Go ahead. Okay, so is there any way that we can work with the proposed legislation we've been given and come up with a compromise to make that happen? I mean, because what you're saying seems to me to be very draconian. If we just reject this, then if we reject this, then we're back to just having to keep the stage two going. Is there any way we can work with this and come to terms?
The answer is maybe. Draconian is what you have before you. There is a process. This is just only one link in the process. So the regulations still have to be published and go through a public vetting, possibly a legislative oversight. If you're asking, are we willing to continue to come to the table, we are. But what we can't do is agree on expensive new mandates 6 years out on equipment that's speculative and impact is speculative. So to the contrary, I think not moving forward today doesn't hinder the process at all. It just continues the discussion.
Any other questions?
I have a follow-up question for the department from that. So do you, is that really the case that from your understanding also, that the equipment is not currently available, so they really can't know the cost of the drip-less nozzles?
That's not the case. We actually, Ohio has in their regulations, and they had for at least a year now, the requirement for low permeation hoses. And I've spoken with the air quality manager within the Ohio EPA, and their facilities have installed these low permeation hoses. That technology's out there. It has been approved by CARB as of this summer, June 2014. CARB has certified these low permeation hoses. They've done staff reports on the feasibility of the VOC reductions that come across from them that are quite compelling. EPA is doing some initial pilot studies at some military bases as well. There's some collaboration going on. We do have vendors here that can speak of some of the availability and the technology. There's at least two manufacturers, Goodyear, VST, producing these low permeation hoses. And the dripless nozzles are also in the market. Husky and a few others are VST as well, manufacturing the dripless nozzles. That is a little bit more of a coming technology. There's not as many requirements out there that are putting them in place, but they're out there. And I think some of our speakers will be talking about a little further, but it's not zero.
Okay.
We did have some background reports that we made our decisions based.
Cost. Do we know the cost?
Yes, we do.
Because it's not on the economic impact.
Well, from currently, and these are just a handful of some of the costs I have. I'm waiting on some additional information, but from a perspective of the stage two nozzles right now, and this is just looking at two manufacturers, VST and Husky. The stage two nozzles currently cost $175. The dripless nozzles are $150 to $100. I think there may be some variation. Conventional nozzles are about $60. But the thing to keep in mind with that is that these dripless nozzles can be rebuilt so that once a conventional nozzle's life usage is up 2-3 years, something of that sort, it's a one-time cost, it's out the door, but these dripless nozzles can be rebuilt several times, so there's a longer-term cost savings that can come across.
Okay, but if I were to compare what they might be able to go to if they didn't have to do the dripless and the low leak hoses, they could go to a $60 nozzle.
Correct.
And now we're making, this reg would make them go to a $150 nozzle.
Yes, but the manufacturers...
I understand, down from 175, correct. But it's still okay.
Correct. Now, the hoses are, this is a previous term of BST, correct me if I'm wrong. Stage 2 hose is $200. The low permeation hose is $125. And conventional is $60.
The manufacturers have provided some data to indicate that, you know, the conventional nozzles last only 1 year, whereas the dripless and other enhanced technology nozzles last longer. So if you equate the cost over a 4 year, 5 year period, then it comes out to be about close to the same, because you can rebuild the newer version, the technology incorporating nozzle, whereas the conventional nozzle is disposed of within 1 year. That's what the manufacturers are prepared to guarantee. The lifetime of the conventional nozzle happens to be much shorter. And so if you calculate the total cost over a 3 or a 5 year period, it comes out that the nozzle with the technology will outlast the nozzle without the technology. But the manufacturers are here. Let them indicate.
Well, so before we, as I said when I framed this up, there's no pressing need to move ahead quickly. I do find it interesting that we've got such pressure to move ahead and fix this, and now we're being asked to delay again. So I think there's a way to move forward on both. And we did have a phase where the electric vehicle charging was more mandatory, but it is totally voluntary now. So I think there's still some confusion on voluntary versus mandatory.
But I hear the concern that a Costco, for instance, can say, all right, we want our people to stay in the store a long time. We're going to put in a charging station. And they get to pull all their stage two out right away. And a small operator has to keep it in. I think that's the concern. Right?
Okay. Well, I think we can work through these things. But let's get the other comments. But I think the way we did the NOx reg, which is you guys charge the department to work with the affected businesses and then come back in about a month, may be a good way to do it. But And I would ask again, we've been asking for literally a year to get the data and analysis from the private sector on dripless nozzles and low permeation hoses, and we just don't have it. So Ellen and Kirk, if you have information you want us to look at, please send it to us, because it's just we just have never seen your work.
Right,
so
I would like to comment on that, because we have no idea, again, other than the information that you'll be presented by the people who benefit and make this equipment, whether anything that's been speculated today aren't true, is true. We have no idea the cost of the noses or hoses. We have no idea that they last longer. We have no idea that they have any benefit to the environment. To this date, we are unable to purchase much of this equipment.
Either one.
At all. So, you know, they're also practicing sending certain things to Mars, and we hope someday that comes true. Until we see this equipment in the marketplace, comments of they last longer. We just really have no idea. So, Pat, I wish I could send you something on dripless and permanent hoses, but the only information out there is what is being touted by the people who benefit of the sale of them. So, you know, maybe, you know what? Technology moves quickly, and it might be a whole different discussion 6 months from now. But right now, there's nothing for us to forward to you.
But when you say there's nothing, what I'm hearing is there's nothing on the longevity of them. But I just heard information about the cost and about their use in another state. So I'm not understanding there's no information. There may be some lack on longevity.
I call a hose supplier and ask you for a little permutation hose, not that. So you know, there's a disconnect somewhere. A dripless nozzle, no one's heard of it. Now, the manufacturers, they might hear about it, they might know about it.
What
do their supplies have? I don't know, but that's a question mark for us.
So your main objection, if I understand correctly, is that there's uncertainty about the technology that may or may not be available for the 2020 potential mandate, and you don't like the fact that it's there's a quid pro quo aspect between that and the electric charging, which has other market issues associated with it.
Well, it should be secondary market, but it shouldn't be. We feel that stage two ought to have been deregulated by now. They're holding the electric market sort of as a carrier there. Or if you want to deregulate right now, you can. Don't you just have to put a charging station? And or you got to put it over at the Kroger store, or over at the Giant store, or over at the mall. You can split the cost of them, don't worry about it. But we feel they're trying to advance the electric market on our regulation. And the small guys can't do that. I mean, they pay a lot down. Like I say, with the cost of deregulating, it's not going to be something that happens all of a sudden overnight. There'll be some that do that as their equipment wears out and everything. And I think that's a good way. And I think it'll stretch an egg for FDA. They got to apply for that. They got to apply to decommission. They got to jump through a couple of hoops, which is not bad. Actually, the MD's got that set up pretty good where they can apply. And they have certain requirements they have to. Protocols they have to follow to decommission. And that process is going to go on, but let's let it start now and let it start going on. As far as the hoses and stuff, though, we have no information on right now. I can't get any. So.
The only thing I add is cost, availability, but I think as deliberators on this commission, I think real life data on impact or environmental benefit should be deliberated, known, and before, like I said, there's this expensive equipment mandate. Costs are expensive, maybe it's not here. I think real life data on how to benefit the environment is something I think everybody's entitled to if they're non-payment on 20.
All right, so since we've got the option to at least hear the rest of the people in question and get more data and then come back to the table. You can get with the stakeholders. There's no pressing need. It doesn't have to be. You don't have to take a vote in the next 5 minutes. Let's hear the rest of the people, ask them the questions, get the information, and then we can decide what we're going to do from that point on. Okay? Anybody object to that? Okay. So next, I'd like to hear from, I think it's Marcus Hilker. Is that correct?
Good. Well, I'm going to University and
yes,
I do research on chronic hydrocarbon contamination, and I and a colleague, Pat Pricey, we recently published a paper on chronic gasoline spills at gas stations, and that paper primarily dealt with liquid gasoline spills. But we are also interested in rainfall emissions, and that relates to the proposed stage two decommissioning. And so that's why I'm here. And I first want to remind you about the fact that gasoline is actually kind of an extreme material. It has a very high vapor pressure, so it's temperature dependent, depends on the chemistry, but it's about 50 kilopascal, that's half of the atmospheric pressure, so that means you cannot even breathe if you're exposed to gasoline vapors that are in equilibrium with liquid gasoline, and that's the case in an empty tank, also in a full tank, and that tank might be a vehicle tank, or it might be an underground storage tank. And also as a result of the high vapor pressure, you actually have quite significant amounts of gasoline in this empty tank volumes. So for example, if you have a cubic meter that is saturated with gasoline vapors, so that weighs about 3 to 4 kilograms. So that's a cubic yard in English units, and 3 to 4 kilograms are 7 to 8 pounds. And the problem is, well, gasoline, it's not good stuff. It contains toxic and carcinogenic compounds. So the BTEX compounds are well known, with benzene known to be a human carcinogen, and the other BTEX compounds, they are suspected to be carcinogenic. So we are talking about major masses that are potentially released to the environment when you're refilling a tank, and if no vapor recovery system is in place. So, just some before I came here, I ran some numbers. So if you have, for example, an average gas station which dispenses 100,000 gallons per month, and if actually no vapor recovery, no, I'm sorry, if only 90% of the fleet had an onboard vapor recovery system installed, and if there was no stage two vapor recovery, so then you would release per year about an equivalent of 180 gallons of liquid gasoline. So, but that would be in the air. So these are non-trivial amounts, and I guess the case that I want to make, I think you need to be very cautious when changing policies that regulate vapor emissions. And I think particularly, I think you need to be aware of the fact that not the entire fleet has these onboard refueling vapor recovery systems installed. And then you have also other types of equipment, well, motorcycles we talked about, and canisters, boats, which do not have vapor recovery, onboard vapor recovery systems installed. And so I think with the proposed phase out, so I'm not against it. But I would be careful. I think the question is, when should it happen? And there might also be a geographic component. Where should it happen? Should you treat kind of urban environments the same way that you treat rural environments? And I hope that the commission accounts for these issues, and potentially we need to collect more data, as also the gentleman and the lady here in the back corner here proposed. I would agree with that, that more good data is needed. And actually, the final thing also is, that I forgot to mention, is I think it's also not very well known how efficient the onboard recovery systems are over the lifetime of an automobile. If they are getting, if an automobile is 20 years old, are you still recovering 98%? Or does that go down? So that cannot be just assumed that they work perfectly. And that's all that I have to say, and I would be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Marcus. Does anybody have any questions?
Yeah. So your main concern about the regulation is the possible reduction in control of toxic components of gasoline, is that correct?
Toxic and, yeah, carcinogenic. And it's actually interesting, it would also affect ground-level ozone. That's another concern.
So are you advocating that we delay this until more information is available for the transition? Because, I'll let you answer. I was going to answer for you.
Well, I would just be cautious. And all that I hear is, so I heard very good stuff from all sides. I think we need more data. And I think I would now be concerned if you actually voted on this today.
Well, which aspects of the regulation as proposed are of greatest concern to you?
So it's the decommissioning of stage two vapor recovery.
And you said 2017 seemed too soon to you. What, do you have a number in mind?
Well, actually, I didn't say that 2017 is too soon. Maybe it's okay, but I think right now we are not in the position, or at least I'm not in the position, maybe you are, to make this call.
Got it.
I guess I have a question about if you could just summarize in a sentence or two what you found in your paper. That's the first question. And then the second is, maybe it's related, is if there is a spillage at the gas station, who's particularly at risk? Is it the person who filled up, or is it, as Lauren was saying, the attendant?
Well, the paper that we published was on the hydrocarbon spills, and it, of course, also dealt with evaporation, because gasoline has this extreme property. It has a very high vapor pressure. And one of the main findings of the paper was that if you have very small droplets, that the fraction of liquid gasoline that infiltrates into the subsurface, into the concrete, which is sometimes assumed to be impermeable. So this fraction just goes up and it can exceed 50%. And that's different, you know, if you have a big spill, if you're just going out there and spilling 10 gallons of gasoline. So then this fraction goes significantly down. And that's, I'm not sure why I should explain that, but that has to do with the effects of capillary suction, which is very, very high and makes sure that even almost impermeable materials can absorb liquid, at least at the beginning.
But isn't it good if the gasoline goes into the cement because it keeps it from going to the atmosphere?
That's an interesting question. But what you want, how you actually design the subsurface of a gas station.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at. Is it a water issue? No. Haven't really answered. What is the public health concern?
I think if it's just stayed in the concrete, I think that actually would be a good idea. If you had some kind of solvent material where you would prevent the gasoline from migrating both upward in the atmosphere and both downward. So the reality is, well, it will actually migrate downward. So the gasoline will likely evaporate when it's sitting in the concrete, and evaporation also allows for downward migration of the spilled gasoline. So that's a known contamination scenario. And even though the gasoline doesn't flow as a liquid through the concrete because it's so impermeable, so diffusion is still, evaporation and subsequent diffusion is still a very effective means for moving gasoline around in the subsurface. So that's the concern, that you get contamination of the underlying sediment and then potentially of groundwater. And all of that, of course, is site-specific. It depends on the elevation of the groundwater table. Sometimes maybe biodegradation might solve the problem, sometimes maybe not.
But your main concern is the VTEX toxicity from evaporation of the materials.
Yeah, so these are the known components of gasoline where we know that they are.
Are you concerned? You're concerned more about toxicity, though. I think somebody else stated this already. You're more concerned about toxicity than you are for creation of ozone pollution.
Oh, I'm also concerned about ozone pollution. Yeah, but sometimes I think that gets forgotten that these compounds are actually carcinogenic, and if you're exposed to these vapors, if you inhale them, so that can have negative health effects. And I'm actually, I think, particularly concerned about gas station attendants. So I think if you're a customer just coming every couple of weeks of the gas station and make sure that you're standing upwind from the gasoline nozzle, that's what I really would recommend. I think you're not getting too much. But if you're working there or if you're living close by, so there could be negative health effects.
Any other questions for Marcus? Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
Question for Park. The current system in place, which we propose to decommission at some point, how compliant people are with? How compliant the station and the owner are with the system right now?
With stage two recovery right now?
We have a fairly strong compliance program, and people are. There's a good record on compliance. Nobody's perfect, but yes, we have a strong compliance program. But if you all are thinking, I mean, the easiest thing for Maryland to do is to leave stage two in place. That's what California is doing. There are costs to the business community. That's why we are moving ahead, because it's a big benefit to the business community. And it appears that the environmental benefits are becoming smaller over time, but that doesn't, I'm not saying that, you know, the analysis we mentioned earlier showed continuing benefits all the way through the 2020 timeframe. So, you know, this is a, MDE is moving forward this because we would like to do this because it helps the business community. I'm not sure that was clear to everybody around the table. That's why we're doing that.
Obviously, that community seems to be based on different groups with slightly different
interests. I agree with you.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Have you worked with members of the business community who are in favor of this as it's written? Because we've heard today only from representatives who are not in favor of the way.
Yes, there are people that are very supportive of what we're doing.
Can I just mention, I just think the we saw these regulations for the first time 4 days ago. I'm not sure how widely this new regulation has been circulated to the other affected businesses, many of which are my members who haven't had an opportunity to comment or even come here today. We saw it on the agenda, I think, late Friday afternoon.
All right, well, we have one. Let's hear. We have one more person that wants to speak. It's Darren Bassler.
Or the fact that it's not available today. Flip to the next slide. It is technology that the dripless nozzle technology has been around since 2008. This is our vapor recovery nozzle that is currently used in California. The dripless technology is all contained within this front end system and this interlock mechanism. It is the same technology that we have used in what we're calling our eco nozzle, which is a dripless, spitless nozzle with no vapor. The only thing that we've done is we've removed the vapor component. So if you look between the two of these designs, all of these front-end components are exactly the same. They've been in use in California since the original inception was 2008 with the executive order issued in 2008, so the testing was previous to that. We were renewed with our EO in 2012, so that it went through another set of testing in 2012. And then we've just instilled a new safety mechanism into this design where if for whatever reason the interlock mechanism were to fail, the nozzle will fail so that you can no longer pump gasoline. So that they know specifically that it has failed and that it can no longer pump gasoline. All of that has been incorporated, and that was approved in California in 2014. So, and we've sold about 40,000 of these units already in 2014. We cover the entire state of California, and we've been in there, as I mentioned, since 2008 when they went to their EVR solution, which is an enhanced vapor recovery. I guess one statement I would make based on some of the comments that were made earlier is an agreement that a balance system, which is this type of system that we have currently in California with our nozzle, is compatible with ORVR, so it would not have an issue in overpressurizing the tanks and thus venting even further. You would be able to use it with the onboard vapor recovery. There are also assist systems in California that were required with the onset of enhanced vapor recovery that are also compatible with stage 2 vapor recovery, and with the ORVR onboard vapor canisters.
But what I wanted to show you by bringing this is that the components are the same. And this has been tested since 2008 four separate times for dripless, spitless performance. So there are California regs that require the specific number of drips that you can have, and if you do spill, how much you're allowed to spill. And this has surpassed those requirements on all occasions. So there is data available. We have supplied that data to MDE. And it that same exact technology is used in this nozzle that is manufactured. It is on site in several states right now. It is not mandated in a lot of states, so it is not widespread, I would say, so it's not all the way across the country, but it is being used. It is on stations, and it has been for about 6 months. And as I said, it's the same nozzle minus the vapor pack. So it is exactly the same technology. Has been through UL, has been approved by UL, and we have gotten some costs, as you'll see in the packet that I sent, that shows it's about 20% less than the current stage two system, and that's an entire hanging hardware set. So that's your nozzle, your hose, your breakaway. It's the entire set that you would have to hang. We did a comparison with three separate distributors. We sell through distribution. So you have three separate quotes in your packet that go through and tell you what the cost of the systems are. As far as the low perm hose, it was mentioned earlier that Ohio has, Ohio mandated this earlier in 2014. They started to implement them and hang them on their sites roughly around the June timeframe. So again, you've had low permeation hoses hanging in Ohio for about 6 months. There has been extensive testing done by California on what the benefit of low permeation hose would be. The current hoses out there give off around 70 pounds per, 70 grams per meter squared of length of hose. And the new ones, the requirement is 10 grams per meter squared per hose. What is shown in the testing that has been done, and this testing is done through UL of the actual permeation portion of it, what has been shown in some of the hoses is that we are actually below that 10 grams per meter squared per day. So there is, again, a benefit out there shown. Through all of the testing that was done in California, there is a calculation that can be made, and the details are, again, in your packet. But based on some assumptions that we made on the throughput of the stations in the state of Maryland, we estimated that you could save about 162,000 pounds per year of emissions just on the number of hoses that would go up. And that would be at a cost of roughly a dollar per pound for the technology itself. Again, keeping in mind that a full hanging hardware set is about 20% less than your current stage two technology that's out there. As far as the nozzle, I think I went through most of this, but when I say the 40,000 fueling positions in California, that's with the brand new technology that has the safety device on it. We have about 70,000 fueling positions that we have our nozzles on that we've been supplying and resupplying to since 2008. It was mentioned that these are repairable and rebuildable. This front end portion right here, which is usually what's damaged in a drive-off condition where someone drives away and leaves the nozzle in the car, this can be replaced and repaired on site. So you don't have to replace the entire nozzle, the casing being a large portion of the cost of the nozzle. You can replace this for far less. And then what we can also do, and we do have this system going in California, is at the end of life of the nozzle, these nozzles can be sent back to us. We strip them completely down, we clean them off, and then we rebuild them using the same casting. And that gives you a reduced cost on your nozzle. So really,
You can buy a new nozzle the first time, but then after use, you can then change out the nozzle and go to one that's been rebuilt, and it's a significantly less cost. Again, that's in your packet. Again, we have installed these in a couple other states. We have offered to the state of Maryland, and we will work with any gasoline station that wants to do this. We've offered for them to come, and we can do a third-party test of those nozzles and its dripless component, and whether or not they would see, you know, what type of benefit you would see. There are very specific requirements in California that we could run through a third party and get those results and bring them back. We just wanted to make sure that that would be acceptable to the state of Maryland if we did that before spending the money, since we do have significant testing already with the state of California on this type of technology design. So our proposal, I guess, you want to move down? I think this has also been brought up that the EPA is looking at a more stringent standard, hopefully, or they're working on looking at that, and their hope is to have it done by October of next year. We all know that the EPA is not quite that quick, but go ahead to the next slide. So our proposal to the state of Maryland would be that this technology is proven technology. It is available today. It's about 20% less than the stage two systems that are on today. And if you were to remove the stage two systems and put on this technology, you would still see emissions benefit, but it would be about 20% less cost of the equipment, but you would also get to be able to remove some of the testing that's required with stage two. So you'd also remove that burden from your owners. And it would just be an alternative to the charging station requirement. So, do you have any questions?
Aaron, two questions. One related to the dripless, spitless performance. Mm-hmm. And you said that they had tested and performed better than the standard. The standard is the CARB standard?
Correct.
And the prevalence of the balance system in California, is there any connection between whether it's a balance system or a vacuum system like we have primarily in Maryland and the dripless, spitless performance?
No. And the actual numbers in the state of California currently are that there are more vacuum systems in the state of California than there are balance systems. However, that is changing at this point in time. Within probably a couple of years, you're going to see a difference when the balance takes over the assist systems. But from a dripless perspective, it's the same technology and it works in the same manner.
And how susceptible is the performance to misuse, or is it foolproof?
As far as, well, the way that the way that our nozzle functions is that with the interlock technology, it will not pump gasoline unless you fully engage the interlock mechanism. And then once you release the mechanism, it stops the flow of gasoline by removing itself from the interlock mechanism. So I don't want to say it's completely 100% foolproof, but you have to engage fully the interlock mechanism to actually flow gasoline to happen.
You have to do it by putting your hand there?
No, when you push it into the vehicle, the filler net. And really, okay. On these, in most cases, the weight of the nozzle is enough to actually push it down. You don't. The old ones, I don't know how familiar you are with the old ones, but you would have a boot on it.
Right.
If you can see the difference here in this one, you have the correlations here where you can actually push it. Because with vapor recovery, you have to have a very tight seal to make sure that you're pulling all the vapors back. With this, you don't need to have that because you're no longer pulling the vapors out of the tank. ORVR is doing that for you. So you just have a standard splash guard or face seal. So you don't have to have all of the corrugations here that you would have normally. And when you actually put this into the tank, the weight of the nozzle actually pushes it down.
I have a couple questions. Although I can probably guess what VST stands
vapor
for.
Vapor systems technology.
That's what I would have guessed. Good. So, nice presentation. What fraction of the, roughly, of the pumps in Maryland are presently made by VST? That's my first question. And second, is there competition for this presently or in the foreseeable future?
We are currently, as far as the nozzles, we don't manufacture pumps, but the nozzles. We are not in the state of California currently.
No, here.
Maryland. Okay. I'm sorry, it's like California. Yeah. So used to saying California.
No worries.
We do not supply into the nozzles into the state of Maryland because you guys do not require enhanced vapor recovery. You only have the stage two.
Right.
So it's a slightly different nozzle. You don't require the dripless spitless performance today.
Okay, so you're not in our market yet.
Correct. But we do have distributors who sell into New Jersey. And we have distributors that do sell into the state for hoses.
Okay, is there competition in place today for this new technology?
Husky has one that's also.
So Husky is a different company that's a competitor.
Correct.
Great.
Not OPW.
OPW has a slightly different nozzle technology, and I don't want to speak ill of them, but they do not have the same dripless technology that we do. It's different.
Are they working on a dripless as far as you know?
As far as I know, they are. As far as I know, they are.
They don't have one yet, as far as you
know. No, but we have, there are three nozzle manufacturers in the state of California that are approved with dripless, spitless performance, and each one of them could very easily do exactly what we did and just remove the vapor path and have a nozzle available.
Yeah, I just like competition.
Absolutely.
Because I think that
I understand.
The cost. They'll compete in what? Okay, so it's you, VST, Husky, and who else in California?
Franklin Fueling is in California, and EMCO is in California.
Okay, so that's four. Okay.
Any other questions for Aaron?
I have one, Ted. What's the cost of a rebuild? She might have said it, I didn't hear it from
you. No, I didn't say it. It was in the presentation, but it's about $135.
A new nozzle is 160 and rebuild
100. It's like 170. Yeah, it's 100. And some of the pricing, I think, we're getting mixed up with what the distributor cost is versus the end user cost. But in the presentation, it has three quotes, so you can actually see what the end user cost would be.
I have a quick question. The Maryland's current systems don't have advanced. So you're not compatible here in Maryland, is that correct?
No, we would still be compatible. What California requires is a system above what Maryland has today. In Maryland, you have stage two, which requires the pulling of the vapors back into the tank. What you don't have is the additional requirements for ORVR compatibility. And the dripless spitless portion of it that was required in 2008 when California went to the dripless spitless. So it's a little bit step above what you guys have here.
So your equipment is compatible or not compatible with the station under Maryland's?
We have balance equipment today that if you were to put a balance site in the state of Maryland, we would be compatible.
There is no balance on the
I understand. We do not have a system.
Okay, then you don't have a system. And then the other last question is about cold air. And there's been, you know, this whole thing about how this reacts in different climates. Mm-hmm. Maryland has tremendous, all you do is look at last winter, different climates than California. Can you talk, do you have any data about how your nozzles and hoses deal with long-term cold air?
Well, the hose itself, I'll start with the hose. The hose itself, the only difference in the hoses that are used today, and we supply hoses into New Jersey and all up and down the East Coast, as well as California. The only difference in the hose is actually an interior barrier layer, which helps with the performance of the permeation. And with the permeation, with the reduced permeation, what the speculation is that what's going to happen is you're not going to be pulling out those plasticizers as much as you are currently because you're not
the vapors are not leaching out as much. So with that, you should have a longer durability. Now, our hoses currently in the state of California last 3 years. We have data on that. We can supply that data. With this, we speculate it will last even longer. Now, as far as the performance should not be changed at all other than the enhanced capability of durability, because the only thing you're changing is adding a barrier layer, and that barrier layer, again, is going to stop the leaching out of the VOCs, which then leaches out the plasticizers, which makes it dry out faster, which makes it crack, and with the continued bending, that's where most hoses fail. So it should be a better, longer lasting
crack.
I'm sorry.
Are you saying these hoses won't check and crack?
I'm saying they should last longer before they do that.
But the outer layer is the same as the hose we got now.
Correct, but you're not
check within a year normally.
But you're no longer going to be leaching those VOCs out through it. Again, you're going from 70 grams per meter squared down to below 10. It's a pretty significant change in what you're allowing to go out of the hose. So our speculation, just based on that engineering, is that it will last longer.
Speculation.
Correct. They haven't been in the market, so I don't have data other than to tell you that that's what the industry expects.
Okay. Any other questions? We're getting behind. We need to catch up a little bit. Okay. So we can have further discussion. We have two options. We have two options. We can either have a motion and take action on the regulation today, or as Tad proposed, since there isn't any real motivation on MVE's part to absolutely have it today, we could then postpone it, come back, you can meet with the stakeholders again, and bring it back at the next meeting or in March. Does anybody have a preference?
I move that we accept Tad's suggestion and continue the dialogue with the stakeholders.
I would propose just not to take any action now, but maybe to give you some feedback.
I would like feedback.
If I were negotiating, which I'm not, if I were negotiating with the station industry on this particular issue of the earlier phase out for electric charging, rather than making it a station operator issue, one concept I might explore would be sort of a regional. Once a region has a certain number of stations, charging stations, let everybody off the hook. So that puts, first of all, it gives the advantage to dense areas that if they have the stations nearby. And maybe let rural areas off the hook even more so, because, I don't know, just some thoughts. And it also could incentivize jurisdictions to say, hey, we're gonna put some in of our own, or we're gonna encourage some new businesses or new construction to put them in and sort of satisfy that need there.
So we've been talking about this for a long time with our stakeholder group, and that option was actually on the table, where there would be a target number, and once we reached that, it was a free ride for everybody. In particular, that initiative really provided huge benefits to small businesses, but that was rejected
by
the stakeholders.
Well, it was rejected because they wanted us to pay for it. No, it wasn't a regional thing. They wanted us to fund it.
All right. Just a thought. And then the other thing I'm hearing really clearly is when you do come back, if you can give the more data you can give us, like here's what the low leakage hoses and the dripless are really going to save, and here's what we're going to lose in recovery if we do it in 2017. Here's what happens if you do it in 2016, 2018. Give us some data on that. And if there's any way to handle the keeping some pumps. I understand it's a whole system issue, but maybe there's a new, I don't know what's in the industry. Maybe there's a smaller system that's capable of handling the portable containers and motorcycles and so on.
But Larry, that's good, but there's still the issue of the nozzle. the current system still a lot of dripping. So this needs to be taken care of too. I mean, even if you did not decommission the phase, which I, you know, we need to.
Because of the direct personnel exposure, you mean?
No, but the drip, that goes to the environment. If we still have all the nozzle which is dripping,
right?
Even, you know, they've taken the vapor away, but this drip goes somewhere, and it goes in the environment.
Maybe I didn't explain myself clearly. So I was saying there's a benefit from that, and so I'd like to know quantification of that benefit compared to what we lose by eliminating the stage two.
Okay, but you said maybe we should have exception for some people not to, you know, to continue the old system. They should be exempt. That's what you said.
No, what I meant was exemption, an allowance to eliminate the stage two earlier in certain areas if the, maybe I didn't express myself clearly. And it had nothing to do. I wasn't saying anything at all about eliminating the low leakage and the drip proof.
We can give you some of that information today. In fact, we do have more detailed information that didn't go out in our fact sheet that we're going to put in our technical support document. But
I'd suggest not giving it today, so we give it
fine,
to us and let us digest.
Just so you understand, we do have that information. We weren't making the regulation without data.
Got it.
Yeah, Ross?
Okay, I want to follow through on what Sonia said about the drips. I mean, to me, the horse trading that I would advocate for is not the electrical vehicle charging in exchange for sooner phase out, but rather the adaptation of the dripless nozzle technology. And, you know, I wouldn't take this position if there was, with all due respect, great presentation, if there was only a single manufacturer and a single company to benefit, then I'm big capitalist here. But since there are multiple manufacturers, there'll be competition. The prices are not exorbitant by any means. I would either make the dripless mandatory or make it mandatory for the early phase out. And I'm particularly uncomfortable with coupling dripless to the ozone standard because our ozone will not benefit from this. Our ozone is NOx, NOx, NOx. The VOCs in our atmosphere from lysoprene from trees. So that's the trading I would advocate. And as a last resort, if EV does stay here, I mean, I don't know the degree to which representatives from the industry would be happy if by 1 to 7 it said 0, or by whatever this number is, 8 to 49 it said 1. Or, you know, if we could just finesse the numbers a little bit. But in my opinion, the EV stuff is kind of a different market. Yeah. It's the shopping center market.
It's not quite tied to that.
Yeah.
Any other discussion?
Yeah. Well, just make sure that's not necessarily true. There are large service station owners who are going to be installing EV charging equipment at their service station, and they are doing it because it's not for everybody.
Oh, well, if they want to do it, they can.
What's that?
If they want to do it, they can. And certainly service stations along the highways, of course. But for the, you know, corner neighborhood one, I think, you know, if it's not walking distance to a shopping center, people are going to...
I would like to point out that California is a heck of a lot colder than Maryland. And as she said, just as she was leaving, talking to me privately here, they do have broken down some of their longevity information on their hoses according to the region of California where they are. So please, I think, since we're going to be looking at the whole state being moderately cold in the wintertime, we ought to have that data as well.
The issue about air toxics, I'd also be interested to hear more about that because certainly Maryland's a master at doing the VOC ozone balance over the years, but how does the abatement of HAPS and the, you know, urban air toxic strategy factor into the decision making?
Dr. Jed Miller has reviewed the toxics aspects, and he can provide his analysis also, you know, to the council. In fact, he was prepared to do something today if the question came up. But at the appropriate time, he will be able to finalize his findings and share them with everybody.
Any other discussion? Okay, well, John has a motion on the table that we delay. We let the Maryland Department of the Environment get back with the stakeholders, get all the additional information that we've requested here, get that all back to us, and that in March we can then take action on this. Is there a second on that motion? Okay, all those in, any discussion before we vote? All those in favor? Put your hand, please, and keep it up for a second if there's a count going on.
That's great, yeah, and then Kevin on the phone.
Yes, I'm in favor.
Okay,
thank you.
Very good.
So we voted a new chair?
This chair's broken.
That chair's been broken. As my last act of power, I'd like to double the salary that we all get.
I can handle that.
Yeah. Two times zero, still zero.
Still do that now.
Okay, any opposed? Any abstentions?
I'll just abstain.
Okay, Larry abstains. Okay, very good. Okay, John?
No, I'm a silent partner. I apologize. Something came up. It's the first one I almost ever missed. I'll be quiet and sit on the side.
No problem. Okay, so we have one more where we have to take action. Is that right, Randy?
Right.
On the VEEP?
A very simple one.
Good.
Yeah.
This one's going to be a simple one.
None of them.
Good. I like that. I'm Marcia Wade. I'm program manager for the Motor Sources Control Program. And I apologize if Randy was more forward thinking than I was. Unless Randy and Tad bother me for slide, I tend to forget about slide. So hopefully this will be a little bit forward and we'll be able to walk through it in a few minutes. But what I wanted to do was just give you a little bit of a reminder background because we don't have the opportunity to bring these regulations to you very often, which is a good that means where everything's running well and we're not making any changes. But what happens on this program, the Vehicle Emissions Inspection Program that we fondly call VEEP, it's jointly administered by both the Maryland Department of the Environment and Motor Vehicle Administration. The Motor Vehicle Administration is in charge of the operation and the administrative aspects of the program, like overseeing the contract for the stations, the contractor and the stations, the contract that runs the stations. They also generate the notices, they handle the administrative waivers, they handle all the kind of things that you as a citizen see when you go to the stations and you are the Department of the Environment is more behind the scenes. We handle the technical stuff, like the test procedures, the cut points for the idle tests. We look at the data. We handle the audits. We certify the chair technicians. More the things that if you fail the test, you need to come and take a look at. So these regulations are jointly adopted. So we do bring them to you as part of the quality process when we go ahead and make some changes. I was hoping that some folks from MBA would be here today, but they had some transition things going on this morning that doesn't look like they're going to be able to make it for us. So I'm going to try to do my best to bat through all of these. Back in March of this year, we got a new MBA administrator. And one of the first things they asked us to do, or we asked the staff to do, is take a look at your regulations and make sure that they accurately reflect the things that are going on in the stations or in your programs, as well as some legislative changes. So I guess I was notified probably in mid to late summer that MBA was going to be taking a look at the VEEP regulations, and that when they had something for us to react to, they'd go ahead and send it over in like the September timeframe. Unfortunately, I didn't have any of that for you for your September meeting, and I didn't want to put more on your agenda if it never actually happened. So I was just kind of waiting until the end of September when I got the information from MBA. And when I did, we kind of looked through it. We thought that, oh, this is straightforward enough that you guys have all this expertise that I think we can handle this in one meeting. So I'm hoping that we can do that. But if you feel that you need a little bit more time, we'd be happy to come back to you at your next meeting. So they really are just keeping with the directive of the administrator at MBA. And what we've done, or MBA did, was go through and align the regulation with some of the things that have been going on in the program since probably 2008, which is the last time, I think, that major overhaul of these regulations and brought them to the committee. And I'm just going to work from the facts about sheet that was provided with your package material, and I have a few extra copies if anyone on the committee needed it. But there's really just four or five basic things that we're trying to do. The first one is to provide an exemption for low-speed vehicles. In the past, low-speed vehicles were typically electric vehicles,
However, during the end of the 2014 legislative session, there was legislation to change the definition of a low-speed vehicle to include gasoline vehicles. And because these low-speed gasoline vehicles aren't certified to any federal certification standards, I can't do any kind of testing on them. So we need to exempt them from the vehicle emissions inspection program. So that's one of the changes that will happen with this amendment. We're also making changes to reflect the current procedures for establishing the test date of a used vehicle. MVA has gone through some system changes with their TARAS and their registration database and everything, and they now have the ability to transfer your test date upon transfer of ownership of your vehicle. In the past, if you had your test in December of 2014, your test would be valid till December of 2016. If you sold your car in January of 2015, unless you took your notice to MVA when you registered your car, you wouldn't know what your date was, and you would most likely get put into a pool of vehicles and just get assigned a date randomly. They have the ability now to transfer that so that when you do the paperwork, the test date will automatically go through, and if I buy your car in January of 2015, the date will stay valid through December of 2016. So that's all that's going to do, and it's something that they've been doing. We just need to change the process on that. We're also going to strengthen repair documentation requirements for vehicles, owners of vehicles that repeatedly fail. We do have some folks that repeatedly come and month after month fail and pay, and they never actually make repairs to their vehicles. So we're going to try to take a stab at this, and after one or two times actually make folks start looking at some repairs, making sure that they are trying to repair the vehicles, not just come in and fail their test consecutively to move through the system. We call them the pay to play folks. We're also going to provide a time extension for individuals that are on active military duty. These are folks that are out of state and can't bring their vehicles in for testing. There are provisions, just like with some of the other exemptions and extensions, that you have to sold the owner of the vehicle, and it's not being used, things like that. And finally, we're going to do some changes to the procedures for repair technicians, repair facility certifications. It just became apparent over the years that was a little bit redundant and too many dates flying around. So instead of having it on a 3-year rolling basis, we're just going to tie it to the certification, your ASE, Automotive Society of Engineering certification. So, and then a couple other things just to correct some slights. We also had some language in there that we didn't remove when we made the changes back in 2008 for the dynamometers. The bucket blind sample stuff, I'm still referring to some of that. So in general, they're very minor. They're just reflecting some things that are going on in the station and correcting some errors and things that we no longer do. So I'm ready to take some questions if you have any.
What's the department's estimate of the percentage of the fleet owners that are deferring repairs and just continuing to pay the penalty instead of doing the inspection and passing inspection?
Kathleen, do you have any?
I would have to.
We'll have to go back and take a look. Yeah. It's not very many.
Yeah.
It's just one of these, as the program's been going on for 30 years now, and this is one of the areas we've identified over time where we might be able to get some incremental benefits from the program. And we're constantly looking at software changes and things like that to tweak it. So this is one of those areas we thought we could. And we'll definitely, now that we'll have a little bit better data, we can come back to you with that in the future if you're interested in that. Once we make these changes and things start working, we can give a look at the data and come back with some information for you.
I thought owners were required to present the record of repair after a failed test before they could take the test again.
Well, that's what we're going to make sure is happening here. I think over the years, it's been unclear as to whether they need to do that or not, and it's just one of the changes that MVA wants to make to strengthen that so that when they get questioned on it, they have regulations to present to the owners and drivers saying, well, this is what the regulation says, and we're enforcing the regulation.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there a fiscal hardship issue in there for folks that have difficulty making those repairs?
MVA, we still have a $450 waiver for emissions-related repairs, and the MVA is more than generous in hardship situations. Again, it's kind of one of those things that they handle. There isn't anything in regulation because they try to handle each case specifically, but they do in times of economic hardships, they are pretty able to work with folks to resolve those issues.
Is there a time extension for medical reasons?
There is for disabled, I think, right?
For disabled, and then there's senior exemptions, but not for medical.
Any other questions for Marsh?
So you said, I think when you spoke, you said like the second or third time you'd start to enforce it more.
But I think on this one, second or subsequent inspection.
Yeah, this you're going to snag people right on the second.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to be a little more lenient than that, but maybe the third from your discussion. I mean, everybody except Lauren has on board, I bet. He can still change his, huh?
He's over there.
He can still throw a new air filter in and try it again. Take his air filter out and try it again.
Any other questions? Is there a motion?
I'll make a motion to accept the department's recommendation.
Thank you, John. Any second on John's motion? Second. Any discussion? Okay, all those in favor of the motion? Kevin?
Kevin on the line?
Oh, there you are. Now I
can.
Yes.
I'm in favor.
Thank you.
any opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, thank you. Okay, but what do you want to do about the briefings?
Well, we've done most of the briefings. We can do one very short briefing on the aftermarket catalyst program and be done in 5 minutes.
Okay.
Then we'll be on time.
Yeah, because some people, Ross has a hard stop.
Yeah, 11:30.
So we're coming up on that.
So, Carl, we're probably going to have to do this in an abbreviated way. So, I'll give you the background. One of the things we're doing, because of the ozone standard, is we've, over the years, worked with the OPC and looked for new ways to reduce NOx emissions from vehicles. This initiative is a recent action by OPC back at the June, I guess it was the fall meeting. A bunch of the OTC states are going to be moving forward with programs to require better aftermarket catalysts. When the catalyst on your car is no longer working, right now the regulatory requirements for what you can replace it with are very out of date. California has moved ahead with better aftermarket catalysts. And this is a briefing, so we're bringing a rule back to you in the next one. We want to give you a heads up. So, Carl, if you could just do an abbreviated version of this.
The basic test has already said why we're doing this. OTC has basically developed a model rule to go ahead with the program. Basically, I'm going to start out saying that most people here know what a catalytic converter is. It's a last resort for a vehicle to clean up the exhaust system. And the catalytic converter contains a combination of precious metals that over time do have contaminants that build up on them. And when they build up to a point where the catalytic converter is no longer effective for the vehicle certification, they fail. So when the converter fails, you have three options to have it replaced. You have the OEM or the manufacturer converter. You have, potentially, if you want to go to a junkyard, pull one from a vehicle that has the same make, model, engine size, all that, and have it installed. You take a risk that it may or may not function, or you can go to a third party or the aftermarket, which is what this reg entails to cover. When you go with the aftermarket regulator or converter, you have two types. You have the federal, which is the current one that's mainly available in Maryland, or a California Ford certified or a CARB certified converter. The federal aftermarket converter program basically has an efficiency of 77:30 for the pollutants of hydrocarbons, carbon monoxide, and NOx. And the converter manufacturer self-certifies to the EPA that their converter meets those requirements, and it's only good. And the warranty on the converter is only good for 25,000 miles. The CARB program requires the converter that is installed, or once they have met the requirement to the vehicle maintain the federal certification level. Basically, if it's a TLEP, that converter needs to meet TLEP standards, ULEP, and so on. Also, basically, it must be OBD2 compatible, because basically, if you put a, say, a federal converter on a California, on a more modern vehicle, you might have to check engine light come on, even though the whole thing is to turn it off. And the CARB program does not allow the use of used converters. Basically, some more things to be on the CARB program. Basically, the CARB reviews the test results from independent labs to certify converters. It's not self-certification via the manufacturer. Once it meets the qualifications, the CARB issues executive orders, and then they do pull and test the converters themselves to make sure they do what they say they do. And also, the warranty is better. It's warranted for 50,000 miles versus the 25,000. It's basically double the life. The reason why an updated program is needed is the federal program has not been updated since 1986. So it's almost a 30-year-old reg. And over that time, you know, technology and vehicle manufacturers have improved. And basically, TAD has already gone over the Ozone Transport Commission push for it. It started in 2009, where OTC made a statement calling for EPA to update federal policy. Again, in 2011, the study was found that, you know, federal converter is not adequately reducing the emissions that are needed today to meet the requirements. Again, in 2011, OTC provided, recommended for them to have a federal program update to meet California. Again, in 2014, we took action, where OTC has taken action saying, hey, the model rule is ready, and also in June, they sent a letter urging EPA action. Basically, when we adopted it in Maryland, we'll move it forward, but it will also continue to push for the federal program. Two OTC states have already initiated a program of this nature, Maine and New York, and other states are moving forward. The benefit of this is somewhere between 30 and 40 tons per day of reductions of knots over OTC region. Wow. So it will definitely serve a benefit here once it's adopted. It's based on California Aftermarket Converter Program. We require the sale and installation of aftermarket converters that meet the CARB standards. And if a state so chooses to, like Vermont, some of the other states had wanted language in there to allow for the sale of used converters back on OBD2. It might be just a popular option up in Vermont to put used converters on. Basically, the industry has supported the OTC's efforts for the past 3 years. We have worked with them. OTC has basically supported the OTC push for a more modern federal rule. The only thing that they have problems with is they would like to see it on a federal level more than just a region-wide. And as you can see, this is the last chart that says, why is the CARB rule better? Basically everything. Converter efficiency is better. It meets more requires them, the modern vehicle, to maintain the same as if they were certified for. The warranty is better, plus it is designed to be compatible with the modern vehicle. And any questions?
Cost difference?
Cost difference is running, what the test studies have shown, for aftermarket only, about $200 to $300 more for a CARB certified converter, more so than just a plain aftermarket. The data I've seen is not, you know, say, is that what installer pays for it versus what the consumer is? I have not seen that, but basically the OTC has indicated that the cost difference is reasonable, about $200 to $300 difference. I'm not sure that's much, but you know, when you're talking the benefits of the California converter guarantee, basically to keep the light out on it versus having it repaired again.
None of the surrounding states have that requirement.
Not as of what the California converter, no, not yet. Only Maine and New York has instituted that yet.
They wouldn't fall for them.
Now, this is just a briefing. We just want to give everybody a heads up. And this is an interesting one because if they succeed, we'll never adopt the rule. What we really want is we want EPA to update the federal requirements. There's a lot of states that are pushing for this, states outside.
outside the agency, Colorado, Oregon. So, you know, we will move ahead. We do this in many cases. States move out, push the envelope. Hopefully we'll get a federal program out of this. New York and Maine have already adopted rules. Other states around us, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware are also moving forward. So we'll be back to you on this one. When we look at what is left for us to regulate in the mobile source sector for NOx, this is the top of the list. Now, there are other federal actions. You know, EPA holds a lot of the cards with mobile source controls. And so this is one of the bigger emission-reducing things the states can actually push themselves. So we'll be back next time.
Okay, good. We have one last housekeeping issue. We have not approved the minutes yet, and that's been pointed out by a couple of council members. Thank you. Is there any discussion about the minutes? Any changes, additions? If not, can I have a motion to approve?
So moved.
So moved. Seconded. All those in favor?
Who's the second? Yeah.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Any opposed or abstentions? Kevin, you good? Okay. I'd like to thank the Maryland Department of the Environment, certainly all the council members and all of our illustrious guests here for everything. John, welcome. A little late, but that's okay. I appreciated the power seat for a change.
And you did have electricity throughout.
And electricity, we thank you. We paid dearly for it. I'm sure you probably raised our rates while you were gone. Everybody have a safe holiday season. We'll see you all in March for our next council meeting.
Thank you all.
I said that.